Good afternoon, Milwaukee. This is the Mark Belling Late Afternoon Show on News Talk 1130 WISN. We're going to begin today's program by talking about several different crime stories. They're not connected. They're all interesting. As opposed to a lot of other stories, many of them don't even raise a larger point, but they're all interesting and worth diving into. But before I get into that, had an interesting experience today that I want to share with the audience. You know, this has always been a weird week in terms of work. Way, 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 way back when I started doing this program in 1941, you were almost here when I started doing the show, right? Year after. Then you came waltzing in here. Anyway, when I started doing this program, this just seems like you talk about things that you could actually do not that long ago, but it seems like 100 years ago. Like, it really wasn't that many years ago that you could smoke on an airplane. I mean, that just seems to me that had to be like, that was like done at the same time you could have slaves. It was just such, so far removed from what our experience is. Now you can't smoke anywhere. You could smoke on an airplane. Well, way back when I started doing this program, the day after Thanksgiving was a regular work day at almost all companies, including ours. I always used to do the show the day after Thanksgiving. It was, you know, Thanksgiving was a holiday and people went back to work the next day. I think what changed that was Black Friday, when that started to become a thing, the whole shopping thing. And then we did some stories on this over the years as the whole thing has evolved and companies essentially just said uncle and threw up their hands and said, okay, screw it. We'll make it a holiday for workers. And the reason that they had to do it is it was brutal for businesses that tried to stay in to fully staff their operations because so many people wanted to take off as a vacation day the day after Thanksgiving. So a lot of companies simply made it a regular, a company holiday on their work schedule, other than companies that have to stay open, you know, on days like that, food, restaurant, business, retail, you know, hospitals, etc. Just about everybody else has now made it, a day of vacation because people turn it into a four-day week. Well, the thing that started happening after that, and again, we've covered this sort of in the past and building up to like a revelation today. The next thing that started to happen, by the way, Paul is the reverse of many people. He used to always take off this week because you would usually go deer hunting, right? Yeah. Anyway, after companies started to pretty much give just about everybody the day off of work, and at our company, it's a paid vacation day, which would mean that if somebody would choose to work that's in an on-air role and, say, be on the air, they would then get a comp day in exchange for that. But the people that, like, don't have on-air roles and so on, there aren't many of those people left. There aren't actually many people left at all in radio, are there? One of these days, we're going to come in here, and you and I are going to be the only employees left. Paul said it's almost, it is just, you know, what? Yeah, there's a few walking, I mean, we've got some of the sales, you know, and the one field for which work remotely makes sense is people who do mostly outdoor sales. And, you know, way back in the day, it seemed to be the salespeople that were always in the building were the ones that were gold bricking and so forth. Now, when somebody's not in the building, you assume that they're gold bricking, that they're using the work at home thing as an excuse to just sit around and do nothing anyway. Revisiting some of the history that we've had of this kind of interesting week, and it's especially interesting, you know, here in Wisconsin with deer hunting, and even last week during the sentencing recommendations in the Brooks Child Waukesha County DA Sue Opper talked about when the parade massacre occurred last year, that actually the weekend before Thanksgiving in Wisconsin is sort of a holiday, and that's when they used to hold, well, until this year, that's when they held the Christmas parade, was the week before Thanksgiving. And as long as I'm on that, before I forget, I've had some questions about this. People are wondering, are they doing a Waukesha Christmas parade again? Yes, they are, but it's pushed back 2 weeks. It's going to be the first weekend of December, and I actually don't have in front of me if it's the Saturday or the Sunday, but there's websites devoted to all of this, but there are a lot, they're shoving it back for a lot of reasons, including that they didn't want it to be, you know, on the same weekend as the massacre, but they also, to their credit, I think it's the right decision, did not want to cancel the event or say don't do it. When it does go on, there'll be a lot of security. Nothing will happen. I mean, that thing that happened was something that happened, but it's not like suddenly this is going to be an event that's going to be targeted, for one thing. The only idiot that would do something like this is now, you know, off of the prison system and so on. But there'll be a lot of security, and I'm sure some of the folks would be reluctant to go, especially those that were involved last year who have bad memories, and others kind of defiant and maybe who don't even normally go to a parade would want to go just to make a statement. Screw it, I'm going to go to the thing. But yes, the Christmas parade in Waukesha will be on, but it's in 2 weekends from... It is the Sunday the 4th, so that would be, and you know, last year when the massacre occurred, it was the Sunday before Thanksgiving. Now it's 10 days after Thanksgiving, so it's just a little later in the season. And anyway, you know, Sue Opper was talking about it's almost like a holiday festive period as you roll into that weekend, because in Wisconsin, deer hunting for many people is a holiday too, and then you have Thanksgiving coming in and the Black Friday, and it's generally a light and jovial mood. And anyway, her point that she was making is how Brooks just stepped into all of this joy and tore and ripped it apart. Anyway, what once companies started to give workers the day after Thanksgiving off, they ended up unwittingly creating a new problem, which is all sorts of people then wanted to have off the days before Thanksgiving, essentially taking 3 days off to get like a 10-day weekend, really, when you think about it, Friday, Saturday, whether Saturday, Sunday of the preceding week, then the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, then you're off Thursday, Friday, then Saturday, Sunday again. And it's become a huge scheduling issue for a lot of companies, and that their vacation requests are overwhelming. Anyway, without identifying anyway, because the story, the background as to where I was is completely uninteresting and unimportant. But I had a meeting today at a local business, at a rather large one, and it was around the noon hour period. And the person who was in there said, "It's weird. We have hardly anybody off this week, the week of Thanksgiving. Usually it's terror. It's an issue for us with, you know," and the person, and I don't know if this is all across employment or maybe it was just aberrational to that company, but I don't know if it has anything to do with the economy or anything to do with anything, but the employer, this large company, said that just about everybody was working as normal this week and not taking off to do any of the other things. I don't know what to make of it, and maybe there's nothing at all to make of it. I do think, and I said this yesterday, and I'll expand about it before I get into our first topics, that I do think this whole Black Friday thing is close to being done. The combination of so many people now shopping online rather than in person, and the retailers themselves recognizing this is really stupid and counterproductive to slash prices to the bone just for the purposes of getting people to come into the store at 6:15 in the morning. You know, I watch these ads and you see the ads that are running. Black Friday starts and it was like a week and a half ago and all of that. And I'm sure they'll still have like the doorbusters and that stuff on the day after Thanksgiving. But you'll recall a few years ago, a lot of stores started opening on Thanksgiving night, which I decried. That's almost done. There's a few that are still doing it, but not many. That didn't work, thankfully. And now I kind of think that the whole, everybody's going to shop the day after Thanksgiving. I mean, still, that will be a huge shopping day, but I think that peaked several years ago, Ed. It's not the thing that it was before, and maybe that has something to do with now not as many people taking the week off, or maybe it was just unique to this company. Like I said, it's hard for us to tell whether a lot of people have taken the week off here because we never see anybody in our building anyway. I had to come in early. I didn't hear Jay's show. Was he on? I wonder if any of our on-air people are off this week. Paul does not know. You're supposed to know these things. Do you have any administrative duties around here anymore? Jay was on it. What about O'Donnell? Don't check again. I asked him. Dan was on today. What? He's off tomorrow. See? So like this whole, you know, the only reason you took it off before is because you were going deer hunting, right? I actually think if you're an employee, this is sort of a, you know, especially back when I was on a regular schedule like everybody else working 5 days a week, getting a 3-day week, you almost look forward to this week. Why take it off? I mean, you're denying yourself your only short week of the year, right? Oh, Paul's taking off the first part of next week. That actually sort of makes sense, other than, I mean, I don't know why it makes sense, because Monday and Tuesday are stupid days to take off, but you're right, rather than take it off in advance of Thanksgiving, by doing it, you rarely come up with a good idea. You're essentially getting 2 3-day work weeks then, right? Yeah, because this weekend, because this is, you know, I don't mean aside from your other duties, but my show's only on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday this week because of Thursday and Friday, and then, see, that's probably smarter. Maybe that's now the new thing, and maybe all these employers are facing massive requests for days off early next week. Maybe you're part of some sort of larger trend. If I figure that out, I'll pass that along in another inane segment to start the program. No, this is a good week to work, isn't it? Yeah, well, all right. Now let's roll into several stories in the news. They have the common denominator of crime. They don't have anything to do with one another, and I'm not making a larger point here about some of the things we talked about in the past about bail or revolving door justice, because actually they don't raise any of those things. The stories are just, unto themselves, a little curious, a little odd, a little unusual, and rather interesting. The first story has been widely reported in the local media, and there still aren't any full explanations for what happened. It has to do with a random attack last week in Burlington of a woman by a man. There are a number of things that are unusual about this, including the fact that at least in Wisconsin, even though the guy is no spring chicken, he doesn't have any criminal or arrest record that I was able to find. Yet he's being accused of a random street assault. Almost always, when there are assaults on the street or things like that, whether they be sexual or physical, it's one of two things. Either the two people know one another and they're just having an argument that goes really haywire, or it's just a crook who does this all the time. According to the criminal complaint and the news accounts that are out there, this is neither. Let me quote from, I've got stories in my hand here from several of the local TV stations. I'll quote Fox 6. They're our news partner here, but most of them have the same information. A Delavan man is charged with multiple counts after Burlington police arrested him during the alleged sexual assault of a woman on Wednesday, November 16th. That would have been a week ago tomorrow. In other words, 6 days ago. Officers arrived at the scene to find the man identified as 62-year-old, and I'm going to enunciate his name rather clearly here, Richard Salmon, assaulting the victim, and I'll provide further information on that statement about the criminal background in a moment, assaulting the victim with a jacket wrapped around her head. Officers intervened and stopped the assault. A criminal complaint states Salmon choked her during the assault. The victim was taken to Aurora Medical Center, Burlington, with serious but non-life-threatening injuries. Officials said the investigation revealed the suspect had approached the woman and threatened to kill her several times during the assault. The woman was able to fight back in self-defense until law enforcement arrived. Police said the man and the victim did not know each other. Police said Salmon attempted to run from the officers but was quickly taken into custody. He's 62. This does not surprise me that he didn't run from the officers. Well, think about being a cop that's on the street. You know, you probably watch all these YouTube videos that everybody watches now when people try to run. When they try to run, the cops almost always catch them. Have you noticed this? I mean, some of these cops are a little fat. The one thing that if you're a cop and you're, I don't mean like one that's, you know, inside doing forensics or something or behind the desk, but if you're on patrol, there are going to be times in which you got to get out of the car and you got to run after someone. What do you do? Who are you talking to in there? What's going on in there? Is there something I need? Oh. What, you were going to say something, but now you've thought better of it? Wait a minute. What were you going to say? Well, anyway, the 62-year-old guy tries to run. They ran him down, and he's now been taken into custody. And according to the criminal complaint, he's facing a number of serious charges: attempted first-degree intentional homicide, second-degree sexual assault, strangulation and suffocation, so forth and so on. Court records indicate that Salmon is due for his initial court appearance this week. After a Friday appearance was adjourned, Burlington police identified this to be an isolated incident and said no threat to the community exists. Of all the communities we have in southeastern Wisconsin, I'm not going to say that Burlington is the safest with the least amount of crime. but it's closer to the top of that good list than it is toward one of the more dangerous communities we have. Yet here you have an allegation that apparently unprovoked, a guy who, as I say, is not a young guy, tried to assault and potentially even kill someone on the street to whom there was no prior relationship. Again, I don't have any larger point to make about the story other than this is unusual. Here in Milwaukee, or when I say here in Milwaukee, I live in Milwaukee, in the Milwaukee area, we have crimes like this all the time. People being assaulted on the street, attempts at sexual assault. Almost always, not always, but almost always, they either are people who know one another or somebody who's been linked to multiple other cases of this, and they've been like, say, 8, 9, 10 reports of street sexual assaults, and authorities are looking for someone, and finally they catch somebody doing one of them. This case, so far at least, has not been linked to any other attacks. So I don't know the background of it. Perhaps it will come out during the further investigation, if there's a criminal, if there's a trial or whatever, as to whether or not this guy was just somebody who got set off for some reason and tried this, or is he somebody who's done it in the past but got away with it? Again, we don't know the answer to that. Now let's move to another story. This one occurred on Sunday morning, meaning it was intention of Saturday night. Bar in Menominee Falls. Again, I'll quote from the Fox 6 report. First of all, the name of the... Every time you say a name of a bar, it just always sounds like the kind of place where something like this would happen. But that's just because you know that it's the name of the bar and you know... It's Sal's Pub. Doesn't it just sound like there'd be trouble at Sal's Pub? Now, the reason it sounds like that is because I just told you there was trouble and you know that the name of it is... But you could come up with the name of any bar and it would sound like a place where there'd be trouble. It, you know, just about every bar has trouble from time to time, right? Sal's Pub. They threw a guy out of the bar for being a goof. Can you imagine how many times this has happened? How many times somebody's been thrown out of a bar for being a goof? It's in the tens of millions in the United States. Think of just the number of times that you've seen where in some bar they had to throw a guy out all the time, right? What generally happens? The answer is nothing. The guy leaves. Now, one of the reasons I think that generally nothing happens is the one thing that we don't have a shortage of is bars. Let's imagine, you know, imagine you. You got thrown out of a bar in Cedarburg. You were in Sal's. Wouldn't you just like go down the street to the next bar, Menominee Falls, and start being? Yeah, I mean, you know, they say when they always try to tell people after a boyfriend or girlfriend dumps them, oh, there's a lot of fish in the sea or whatever. Well, there's a lot of bars on the street, if you know what I mean. I think that's probably the biggest reason that nobody much cares. I mean, if you're like smashed and you're causing trouble and they throw you out, just go somewhere else, right? Or go home, but, you know. The story's serious. Fortunately, it doesn't end with an injury situation, but authorities say that the man, he's been identified as Dylan, and I'll again pronounce his name carefully, Breidenbach, that's with a D, B-R-E-I-D as in dog, E-N-B-A-C-H, had been harassing customers earlier in the evening and was asked to leave before being escorted out. Now, the Fox 6 story doesn't indicate what nature the harassment took, but it doesn't take a lot of imagination. We've all seen people in bars, and sometimes there's somebody that's just argumentative, and sometimes people are out there asking people for money. In some cases, they're just being belligerent. There have been instances, you know, of people butting into conversations, etc. It's probably just one of these many types of things. So anyway, they throw them out of the bar. They say escort it out. That means that you not only are thrown out of the bar, somebody goes with you because you're probably not cooperating with being thrown out of the bar, right? Have you ever been thrown out of a bar? Yeah. You know, it's the kind of thing that I was thinking the same thing. It would be like 40 years. I mean, I have to think like about college or something. Did that ever happen? I mean, I've had like okay, it's closing time, you got to leave, and then, okay, no, you really got to leave, but that doesn't count. I mean, being thrown out during the time that they're open for actual conduct. See, now that's the other thing. You're with a group of people, and sometimes you all have to leave, but it's because of things that other people in your group were doing. You're some knob, and it's in your group, and I'm sure that happened to me. I just don't recall it. Because, you know, there's always some knob who does something like, why did we all cooperate? Why didn't we all just make that guy leave? Yeah, he is a friend, and yeah, all right. Anyway. And in this instance, however, Breidenbach returns with a rifle. Let me quote the Fox 6 report. He later returned with a large caliber rifle. Police said, firing one round. Now we're getting serious. Customers then took him down and police arrived. Now let me interject on this story. As you know, I am an opponent of all gun ban laws. I think that the best single thing that we could do to prevent these kinds of mass shootings and mass attacks that occur, you know, we had another terrible one over the weekend out in Colorado Springs and so on, is we need to have more people in society who are armed, because almost always when you have one of these mass attacks, it's one person with a gun or some type of weapon going after a bunch of people who are unarmed and can't do anything to stop him. The Brooks case of the Waukesha Christmas Parade is an odd version of that because he was using a vehicle. But almost always when you have a situation in which somebody tries to commit violence with a large number of potential victims, there's nobody there to shoot back. The one instance in which I've said I think that businesses are doing the right thing when they ban guns is bars. Now, again, I want to make it clear. I think it should be the right of the business to decide. Just as I think it should have been the right of the business to decide if there was a smoking ban. There should be a right of a business to decide what kind of music you're going to play. There should be a right of a business to determine to cut somebody off or not cut somebody off. If you operate, whether it's a bar or whatever it is, I think, you know, if the business wants to run the business in the fashion that they want to run it, they ought to have their right. So again, I think that businesses have every right to disagree with me on this, but I think it's generally bad policy to allow people with guns to come in to bars. And the reason I believe this is some people can't handle their alcohol, and I don't know that you want to have a weapon in their hands as opposed to simply their fists. I just think it's the kind of situation that can make things more dangerous. But if you are going to have a weapons ban, I think you have to be somewhat proactive and kind of trying to find out if somebody has a weapon. Otherwise, the person who is determined to cause trouble is going to be the one that was armed. Well, in this case, the guy wasn't armed when he was in the bar. He was thrown out, but he came back. And he came back with a rifle. Next key to the story, customers then took him down until police arrived. Let me direct your attention to the Colorado Springs case where the guy went into the gay club and started shooting people. That stopped, and obviously there were multiple victims, but he was finally stopped when customers fought back and were able to essentially knock him out. That a couple of people, I think they said one or two of them had military background or something, and they were able to take the individual down. We don't even know how many more victims there would be. In the case of Breidenbach, the Menominee Falls case, I pulled the online circuit court record on this, and in this case, I didn't find any other indication of a criminal background with regard to Breidenbach. He's 22, of course. We don't know what happened when he was a juvenile, whether or not there was anything there or not, but there wasn't anything else. Yet in this instance, he's facing numerous felony charges, attempted first-degree intentional homicide, use of a violent weapon, use of a dangerous weapon, first degree recklessly endangering safety, so forth and so on. He's being held in the Waukesha County Jail, and at least at his initial intake, which was is today the 21st or 22nd? 22nd. So he would have had his first court hearing yesterday, the 21st. They did set bail, cash bail, at $1 million. Now, that may be lowered later on, but clearly they're taking that case seriously, and I think that that's probably an appropriate bail. You don't know what is going on with this guy, and I don't know what was going on with this guy. So I want to make it clear that I'm now discussing this in the generic, but One of the things that Paul and I are on the same page on that I think almost nobody ever comments on, and again, I want to make it clear, I don't know that that's what happened in this case. I am just seeing so much behavior of people going off the rails in otherwise normal situations that we never saw before. And I have to think that some of this has to do with drugs. And I think that what's going on, and again, I don't know if this has anything to do with this case in particular, but where you see so many cases of people just get completely out of control over, if not nothing, nothing major. I think it's not only that the use of drugs, it's that you've got multiple types of drugs or maybe multiple drugs and alcohol all being mixed together. I mean, anybody who's on a lot of prescription medications, like, say, me, are you getting up there now? The cutoff on a lot is five or more. So, you know, I mean, try having a stroke and then try having a history of heart disease in your family and now get migraines like I get and so on. And, you know, I look at the pharmacy in there, I wonder if I'm now, like, do I get more than half the kinds of pills that you have? That's getting hard. You know, I once talked to a pharmacist about that. You know how many more drugs there are now than there were 20 years ago? They have to obviously know about all of them. But think back when you were like a kid and you'd walk into the drugstore, there were like 25 or 30 bottles. That's all that there was that was drugs. And now there's like all these different drugs and some of them for multiple things. Anyway, the point that I was to make is one of the things that the pharmacist always tells you when you get a prescription for the first time is whether it interacts with anything else that they have. And they usually check. They check your history. In other words, if I'm on a certain blood pressure medication, they'll quickly look at it to see if I'm on some other medication that counteracts that. And your doctor's supposed to take that into consideration. That's why when you go into the doctor, I don't know if this happens with you, but I'm part of Aurora. Every single time they go through all the medications that I'm on to see if I'm still on this or if somebody other doctor might have added a new one. And the reason they're doing that is, again, the concern for prescribing something that interacts with something else. Well, that's the concern that we take about, you know, legal prescription medication. What about all this illegal stuff that people are taking out there that's in, this is interacting with that and the next thing and the next thing and the next thing? That's where I was going with my next point. I commented to Paul when we were carrying last week, I believe it was Wednesday, the sentencing of, I think it was Wednesday. Was it Wednesday or Thursday that Daryl Brooks was sentenced? I think it was Wednesday of last week. Yeah. In which Judge Dora was sentencing Brooks. And they went through at length, you know, she was reading from, first of all, the psychological reports on him and so on. And one of the things that came up with regard to Brooks was long-term use of cannabis, which, of course, is the active ingredient in marijuana or part of marijuana. And there have been stories done on this point, and it just requires emphasis again. Virtually every single time we have one of these cases of somebody who commits mass violence like this, it turns out to be somebody who's on pot. Now, Brooks was not typical of most of them. Most of these cases in which somebody like goes into a mall or goes into a school or goes into a public place and shoots the whole place up or something like that, it's often young males. They're often always on the internet. They're often alienated. Virtually every case, there's no father figure in their life and so on. And Brooks didn't fit all of those patterns. First of all, he's older than most of the mass killers, Ed. Secondly, he was somebody who had obviously a lot of girlfriends. Look at all of the different women that he had children with and so on. He doesn't fit all of the profiles that are out there. But almost all these cases, when you come up with these people that go nuts or people that make threats and then 2 weeks later they act on them and they do a terrible thing, when you read into the thing, it's just extraordinary to me that almost always you hear about pot use. Now, that doesn't mean that the pot caused it. There's the old, is it coincidental or is it causation? It may well be that somebody who's a loader and somebody who's alienated is somebody who's going to smoke pot because they're looking for some buzz to bring joy into their life, so they go to pot. And maybe the pot isn't the thing that triggered their violence. Maybe because they're an alienated person, they would be prone to use pot. But it just seems, and again, almost everyone who smokes pot doesn't do anything terrible. But it does seem as though among that minority of people that cause mass violence, there is a common thread of excessive marijuana use. And I suspect that there's something in there that can, for people that are wired wrong in the first place, can serve as a trigger. Now let's add all this stuff that people are mixing things with. Meth is unbelievably powerful. And fentanyl is unbelievably powerful. But they do the opposite things, and we're now hearing these stories of people that are mixing the two. People that want to get the high that they get from the fentanyl, the unbelievable buzz, and they want to get the jagged, wired, manic thrill that you get from meth. So they're taking the two of them and they kind of fight against one another and create an even more toxic kind of high. And again, on this case of Menominee Falls, I don't know if the guy was simply drunk, hacked off about something or another, or if there were other things going on. But for crying out loud, for a guy that doesn't have a criminal record, they throw him out of a bar. So you get thrown out of a bar. How does that become, in no matter how mad you are, rationale to go back to? And I get, we don't know if he went home or if the gun was in his car, but he left. And then he comes back in with a rifle and shoots. Well, now Paul mentions the other thing. Again, I don't know if it's on the increase, but the whole area of schizophrenia, bipolar, and so on. You know, Brooks tried to claim that he was bipolar. Again, I don't think he's ever been diagnosed as it. I think he might have just thrown it out when he was coming up with something. Or maybe he is, maybe he is, maybe he isn't. But, you know, bipolar and schizophrenia has been around forever. And remember when I was younger, I think I've told this story a couple of times, I dated a woman who had a sister who had a mental illness. And she wasn't at all dangerous. She just had a mental illness. That's all it was. She was one of those people who thought that there were messages and voices that were being sent to her, and she was convinced of it. She wasn't going to hurt anybody. She wasn't a dangerous person. She just had these ridiculous beliefs that weren't based on anything. What it seems to me now is that the people who are bipolar or they're even more manic than ever before. Now, it may be that they just don't want to take their meds, or I wonder if a lot of the people who have this are now taking, instead of taking their proper prescription medication to control them, they're instead taking illegal drugs, which takes the extremities of their own mental health situation and makes it worse. But Paul says, and then add alcohol to all of it. But in this case, again, I don't know the backstory. Maybe it'll come out of the guy on Menominee Falls. He doesn't have a criminal record. It doesn't look like he's been doing this sort of thing all over the place, but just think about, okay, maybe you're drunk, maybe you're in a bad mood, you're bothering people in a bar, they throw you out. So what? Most of us have nine things worse than that happen to us every single week. I just see more indications that young people, and it started with the millennials and it may be continuing with the Z's, unable to handle anything bad. I mean, you could take it through all the, it's unfair, I should have to pay back your student loans, I can't handle this, I can't handle that. And I get that some things are worse for young people than they, you know, I think when I was a kid, the kind of bullying that went on is nothing compared to what happens now when you can get bullied over the internet. You know, when Paul was a kid, somebody could call him an obnoxious name, say he's ugly, or say, we're not going to let you go hang out with us. Fine, that's two guys saying it. Now you can put something on the internet and 15 million people can see this terrible thing that was said about you. And we all know that people can be even meaner when they're online than they are in person. So I get that a lot of young people are facing hardships and adversities that are meaner and more extreme than existed in the past. But boy, I mean, just think about it even now. Think about it. Let's imagine you weren't doing anything wrong, but somebody wanted you thrown out of a bar because they don't like that you're on my show, so they made up something and lied to the owner and said that you said something bad. So they threw you out. You'd be hacked off about it, right? Are you going to go home and get a gun and okay, fine. They're all jerks. You're not going to try to kill anybody. I mean, life is just filled with the sorts of things that hack you all off, but now we have more and more people, it seems to me, that do, this is going to follow the guy for the rest of his life because he couldn't just put up with the fact that he was thrown out of a bar. Unless, of course, there's more to the story, and maybe there is, maybe there isn't, about things that he had going on inside of him having to do with the substances that he was ingesting. But, and we all know that there's a difference between happy drunks and mean drunks, and I become proud. We all become a little bit more vociferous, and then I just get tired. What do you get? You probably talk too much, and then you like go, what? Talk way too loud, and then you like, then you go to bed. That's kind of where I am. I talk a little bit louder, get a little bit, but I don't get meaner. Some people, you know, mean drunks, don't you? Yeah, some people do, and so on. But again, there's nothing in this guy's record that indicates he's done. Now, maybe he did close to bad things. We don't know. The story, though, is worth noting, and I just look at all the states that are legalizing marijuana and how we're wandering down this path without considering how many problems you're going to cause with people that aren't capable of doing it. And you could say it, I suppose, about just about anything else that you would legalize. There's an enormously long story in today's Wall Street Journal about the problems going on all over the United States with the legalization now in most states of sports betting. That all these states have legalized sports betting without considering the ramifications. Well, I will agree with them on this. They haven't considered the ramifications. They're all just kind of doing it. Forever, you could only legally gamble on sports in one state, Nevada. Now, everybody knows that illegally zillions of people did it. But there is a reason why all these other states didn't allow it. And then all of a sudden, pretty much all of them are now allowing it. Well, clearly, there are going to be people who are going to ruin their lives over it. On the other hand, 99% of the people who are going to do it aren't going to ruin anything. Do you not allow something to be done because 1% or 2% of the people can't handle it? If that becomes the standard, then we have to ban everything, including alcohol, including all of the other things that most people can handle, but some people cannot. And the final story that I want to get to that deals with the issue of crime might be the most interesting one of all. We've been following this one. There's been a lot of reporting on this by a couple of the TV stations, particularly Fox 6, and I've been doing some piggybacking on it, the case of Kenneth Twyman. To refresh your memory, do you need your memory refreshed? Well, you actually, in general, need your memory. I think, wouldn't that be great if we could all just reboot ourselves the way you did with the phone? Something goofy was going on with my phone. I'm sure I had the thing in my pocket. I'm sure I bumped the wrong thing. And it was on there. It had something about formatting that was on here. And there were like 97 different screens. And I tried to swipe right, swipe left. Nothing happened. You know, turn it off. Next thing, you turn it off. You turn it back on. All of that was gone. Would that be, that, I suppose that's what sleeping is. But, right? And kind of is that. Kenneth Twyman. This is the guy that has been on this Wisconsin's most wanted list. Meaning, he's a suspect that has been wanted either for questioning, or there's a warrant, or is convicted, or he's skipped. It can be any number of things, but they're out there. They're considered dangerous. They don't put you on this list unless you're thought to be dangerous. And then after catching him, he was released on bail. And he got put back on the 10 most wanted list. They caught him and he got released again. In the most recent instance, after he was caught yet again and his bail was raised to $100,000, somebody came in and bailed him out. In this case, the guy that bailed him out is a well-known and prominent guy. Whenever you have a criminal nickname, that means you're sort of prominent. The mobsters always had those nicknames, right? Mobsters and drug dealers are usually the ones that have nicknames. Not too many other types of criminals have nicknames, do they? Like, Daryl Brooks doesn't have any nicknames, does he? Well, for a while, he claimed he didn't even have a name. He kept saying, I don't recognize, give his consent to be recognized by that name. So he went the opposite direction. He not only didn't have a nickname, he claimed that he didn't have a name at all. Serial killers will sometimes get them. You're right. Usually they don't give themselves that name. But when the mobsters or the drug dealers have them, they're perfectly fine with having those names. Like all those mobsters that have all these, you know, Big Tuna, Cardo, and all of that, they're all fine with it. They don't seem to mind having that name, right? Well, Twyman was bailed out by a guy whose street name is White Boy Richie. Now, the thing about nicknames is you might assume, therefore, that the guy is white. However, nicknames are often, whenever you know a guy's nickname is Tiny, guaranteed that person is fat. Yeah, so it doesn't really always follow. So nicknames can be a little confusing about that, but in this instance, he is white. And he was convicted of running a massive drug operation, big-time drug dealer. I'm guessing they called him White Boy Richie because most of the other drug dealers were white, right? That's got to be how he got his name, right? So, he also runs a construction business on the south side of Milwaukee. And back when he was convicted in 2018, he was accused of selling large amounts of narcotics from his construction business on the south side of Milwaukee. The guy's name is Richard Stulo. He bailed Kenneth Twyman, this guy who keeps getting released, out of jail. He came up with $100,000, actually $112,000 when you counted the total cost, posted $112,000. And in Wisconsin, they don't have like bonds, like the states that have the bail bondsman. And as we finally try to deal with the bail issue, maybe that's one of the things we have to look at. I've always thought that we are very wise in Wisconsin not to have bail bondsmen, because why do we need to make it even easier for criminals to get out of jail? Why let somebody else put up money to get even more criminals freed? I didn't see what possible value bail bondsmen serve at all. They just seem to be parasites who benefit off of crime. Every time somebody gets arrested, it's an opportunity for them to get a commission to spring somebody out of jail, not to mention the fact that just about everybody that seems to go into that business seems like a giant sleazebag, don't they? Like these ones that are on TV, you know, that they all just seem... Well, we're one of the few states that doesn't have bondsmen. You've got to, when they set the dollar figure, say $100,000, you got to put up $100,000 in cash. You have to have that money there. You can't get like a bondsman to post a bond in lieu of that. We have things like signature bonds where all you have to do is sign your name and so on. But in this case, $100,000 was put up by Stulo. And the story was covered, as I mentioned, on Fox 6, and we talked about it last week. There's a new chapter in the story. Do you know what that new chapter is? White Boy Richie has reconsidered and went into court and said, I want my money back. I don't want to have the bail on this guy anymore. Now, I don't know. You can't trust what anybody says. I don't know if it might have dawned on Stulo, you know, if this guy flees, they're going to keep your $100,000. And it dawned on him that this might be a pretty big risk. I don't know what their relationship is as to why one bad guy is getting bailed out by another bad guy. But Stulo showed up in court and said, I want my money back. Now, normally, you can't just get your money back because the guy has been sprung. And there usually isn't. It's not like in most cases, like for instance, if I bail out Paul and I decide 2 weeks later I wish I hadn't done it, it's not like I can go get my money and then they'll go put him back in jail. It's not like you can like go in and out and, okay, I'll put the bail up today and not tomorrow and so forth and so on. In this instance, however, the judge, Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Ellen Brostrom, said that she was planning to raise the bail anyway because she was bothered that somebody came up and raised the money for Twyman. Fox 6 contacted Stulo and asked him, well, now, you know, after you bailed the guy out in the first place, why are you doing it? And he said, I should not have bailed him out at all. As I mentioned, Stulo is now, even though he's a convicted drug dealer, he's free and he's back running his construction business again. And he's saying, this has been bad for my business. Now, I'm surprised, I'll admit, I'm surprised he's still in business at all. I mean, with all the construction companies that are out there, and he does a lot of asbestos abatement, he runs a company called Colt Construction. I know that there's been, for a lot of jobs, an incredible shortage. It's been hard to get a contractor and so on. Are you going to hire a notorious drug dealer, have him come into your home to yank the asbestos out, or don't you think you might be able to find somebody better than that? Well, anyway, Stulo's saying, you know, this is apparently he's getting some grief from some of the contractors that have hired him on a subcontracting basis to go out and do this. And he said, I never should have done it. Then he apologized to Fox 6 for blowing them off when the Fox 6 reporter asked Stulo, a.k.a. White Boy Richie, why he bailed out Kenneth Twyman. He kind of blew him off and he apologized to him for that. So, and I'll quote from the Fox 6 story and the reaction here from the judge, who surprised both the prosecutor and the defense by not wanting Twyman released. In a letter to the court, he wrote, this is the letter from Stulo, I feel Kenneth Twyman is a flight risk. Bad publicity is hurting my reputation. I regret posting this bail. So he asked to get his money back, and Judge Bostrom said she's going to grant Stulo's request. The story says that that was a surprise to both the defense and the prosecution, but in this case, the reason that the judge is granting the request is she doesn't think the guy should be released either. So by allowing the money to be refunded, that means that there's an arrest warrant out, and believe it or not, Twyman is now wanted again. Has anybody been on this most wanted list? Remarkable that a guy can be this wanted and be able to keep getting out, and then they put him back on the wanted list. Quoting the Assistant District Attorney Paul Tiffin, he works for John Chisholm. Attorney Richards and I, that's well-known criminal defense attorney Mark Richards, probably best known for the Rittenhouse case. And I thought Mr. Twyman might be out of custody, said Assistant District Attorney Paul Tiffin. But after seeing the Fox 6 story, Brostrom, that's the judge, said she was not going to let that happen. The court was considering raising his bail in this case given the information that had been provided to me. So Twyman's currently in the Waukesha County Jail. After the change of heart from Richard Stulo on bailing, again, as I said, none of these stories have anything in common with one another other than they all kind of deal with crime, and all of them are interesting in a sort of weird and unusual way. As for this guy Stulo, it's another thing. When you know that somebody is a convicted crook, you could say, well, doesn't he sound like a crook? But, you know, you got the baggage of knowing that he is a convicted crook, but doesn't, you know, Stulo, doesn't that just sound like a crook's name? I mean, maybe it's because you think a stool pigeon or stoolie or something, and there's probably a zillion people listening out, my name is Stulo and I'm not a crook, but... You know, then he gets the nickname White Boy Richie. That just doesn't sound like a nickname that somebody who's not somebody who's in trouble would ever get, right? But yeah, it does sound like something. That's Sopranos. That's what I say. The Sopranos were all crooks. That's why they all had those nicknames. They have good nicknames. The thing about nicknames for crooks, though, is it's hard to screw that up. I mean, if you come up with a boring nickname, you're just not any good at being able to do it. I mean, they had great names on the Sopranos. People debate which was the best. I mean, everybody when this is asked, there's always two that are the finalists: Big Pussy and Uncle Junior. It's one or the other. There are a lot of them who had nicknames. But those are, what? Well, Paulie Walnuts. See, that's not up there with Big Pussy or Uncle Junior. And yeah, he did. What's his name? Sirica. Tony Sirico. He did just die. Oh, just about everybody just died. Did you pull my audio for that thing? I can't tell you because then the audience will know what I mean. No, the other. Yeah. Oh, you didn't know why I had you do that. You did know that. I don't want to tease the audience with this topic with something that we were going to do a little bit later on in the program. But if you're a baby boomer right now, you just keep saying, you're just seeing people drive. And I, this has obviously happened with the generation. The World War II generation went through this 20 years ago where every day they were going to a different funeral and so on. But in my case, it's now like some of the people, you know, mostly a little bit older than you, but all of my icons from when I was a kid, they're dropping dead right and left. Well, if they're an icon when I was a kid, they're probably 15 years older than me. Well, they're in the era where just about everybody starts dropping over here, there, and so forth and so on. Paul says with his friends, all of his friends. Well, that's bad, obviously, and you had a tragedy in your own personal life with regard to somebody's parent. But I will tell you this, Paul: the situation only gets worse. Now it's your parents. It's the friends of all of your friends' parents are dying. Give it a little few more years. It's for all of your friends. That's the whole thing about this. None of this ever gets better. The only thing, and I've heard this from a few of the guys that make it into their 90s, when, you know, literally all of their friends are dead and they feel a little bit lonely, the one thing they could say is they could sort of, I outlasted them all, you know, in other words, that it's some sort of strength because of how well they took care of themselves, that there they are still standing when everybody else is dead. All right. Do want to quickly remind you that we're going to be doing the football picking contest on the program tomorrow. Again, for obvious reasons, Thursday being Thanksgiving. I haven't looked at any of the games yet other than the ones that I obviously know who plays. Like, I know the Packers play the Eagles and I know the Badgers play Minnesota for that Axon Saturday. I've got this weird feeling that Green Bay is going to go to Philadelphia and win, but I got to think this through. That could be a ridiculous thing. So that's not a prediction. It's just something. If there's one thing that makes sense in a football season that hasn't made any sense so far this year, it's that you see that things are coming completely out of nowhere. Like no one saw the Rams being terrible this year. And I certainly did not see Minnesota losing by 37 points at home to Dallas after they started the season 8-1, and they looked like the worst team in the NFL this past Sunday. I mean, so to rule the notion out of the Packers going in and beating Philadelphia, you can't rule out anything this year in the NFL. To me, it wasn't shocking that Dallas beat the Vikings. It was shocking to me that the Vikings didn't show up at all, that they played worse in that game than Green Bay has played in any of their games this year, and Minnesota hadn't played a bad game all year. I mean, I was just stunned at that, and I don't know what the explanation. I mean, I get, okay, you're flat, and I also get Minnesota has no sense of urgency because they're a zillion games into first place and all of that, but that explains losing by 10. It doesn't explain losing by 37 points. Well, you know, there's a little bit of blowback going on about the, was it the Monday night game, last night's game in Mexico City, Arizona and San Francisco? Yeah, where Troy Aikman essentially accused Arizona of quitting. And there was a play where Kittle, the San Francisco tight end, is running into the end zone, and an Arizona defensive back clearly can drill him at the 5-yard line, and he stepped aside and just let Kittle run right by him and go in, and they've been replaying that thing all day. There's now talk that the Arizona coach might be fired when you see a team where a guy just, I'm not going to tackle this guy, I don't want to get hurt. That's quitting. Now, the Packers haven't reached that point yet. I mean, but that isn't tanking it, because the game was already over. They're down by a zillion points. That's just the guy who figured, okay, we're losing anyway, I'm not going to tackle this. And, you know, I don't want to tackle George Kittle either. Who is the best tight end in the NFL? Is it Kelce or Kittle? It's one or the other, right? It's Kelce or Kittle. I mean, and I just look at the Packers situation, and, you know, it's all hindsight. Before his injury, Tonyan looked like he was becoming one of the better tight ends in the NFL. But can you, I mean, you look at the gap between Green Bay and other teams, the ability of some teams to have a dominant tight end and Green Bay not having a tight end that you can even throw the ball to. I mean, Mercedes Lewis is essentially just a lineman right now. He's not really a receiver. Tonyan, and again, it's not his fault. He had a terrible injury, and maybe he'll bounce back better next year. But between not having any wide receivers that are particularly good, the absence of a tight end position, and I think that just has to come back to Gutekunst, the general manager, that some of the things that happened this year that I admit I thought the Packers were a Super Bowl contender going into the season. And, you know, we talk about our football picking contest, and I'm having a great year, but boy, I've been wrong about a lot of things. Fortunately, they generally haven't been the game I was picking in an individual week, but I thought the Packers were loaded on defense and that the offense is about as good as last year. I thought they should have won the Super Bowl last year, that it was simply one unfortunate game that stopped them from getting there, and I didn't see any reason why they wouldn't be right back in that position, and they're nowhere near it, but at least with the Packers, you can see the explanations. What's the explanation for the Rams? Has anybody come up with one? Well, Cooper is cuffed and hurt now. Like 2 weeks ago, he got hurt. They've been terrible from the beginning of the year. But the Super Bowl hangover, it's usually the Super Bowl loser that has the hangover. You have to go all the way back. I think the last Super Bowl winner to have a losing season was Tampa Bay when Gruden won it. Or at least the last one to fall apart. I think the Tampa Bay, after winning the Super Bowl the year that Gruden won it down in Tampa, they went 5-11 or something like that. To have an atrocious season, not just an underperforming season, but an atrocious season after winning the Super Bowl, usually, you know, the quarterback retires or something. But the Rams pretty much have all, you know, Cups injury has been recent, but their quarterback's back. Aaron Donald is back. I mean, just about everybody is still on that team. All right. Covered a lot of mileage in that segment. Talk 1130 WISN, Mark Belling, late afternoon show. We used to have this thing where the busiest travel day of the year was always the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. And then some people said that the numbers got to that it was the Sunday at the end of Thanksgiving with everybody going home. Well, now with this trend that I was talking about earlier about so many people taking the week off, the airlines really are busy for 4 or 5 days leading up to Thanksgiving, and you don't have a huge crush on one day or another. In any event, a lot of people are also traveling this year by driving, and a big reason for that, as numerous stories have indicated, is just there is such a reduction in the number of flights by the airlines because of their employee shortages that a lot of people who wanted to fly either see such incredibly high fares or they can't book a flight, that pretty much everything is sold out. So there have been a lot of reports about the number of people that are driving instead of flying this year. So let's give you the Thanksgiving weather forecast. And for our part of the country, it is about as good as you could ask for this time of the year. For tonight, mostly clear with a low of 30. Tomorrow, the day before Thanksgiving, really a good day for late November. Mostly sunny, warmer. Should cross 50 to 52. Thanksgiving Day itself, you don't want Thanksgiving to be cold, do you? It's not like Christmas where some people want a white Christmas. You don't want Thanksgiving to be anything, do you? No. Does anybody? Do you know anybody who I wish it was cold for Thanksgiving? No. Good. Well, you don't have any oddball relative who would say that? The kind of contrarian that's just opposite of anything that would be common sense? The oddball contrarians appear to be in the majority. I mean, look at the last election. Apparently, the kind of wingnuts that would say just whatever stupid thing is out there appear to be over 50% of this country. Mandela Barnes got 49% of the vote for the United States Senator. For those of you who think that we don't live in a world in which half the people literally have lost their marbles, consider that. Anyway, for Thanksgiving, mostly cloudy. A few afternoon rain showers are out there. Otherwise, very nice. High 52. Not a lot of sun, but mild. For Friday, the day after, which I guess we still call Black Friday, partly sunny, high 46. Saturday, partly sunny with a chance for rain showers at night, high 49. Now, Sunday, which is a huge travel day always, it's the end of deer hunting. It's when all the college kids drive back to campus after the Thanksgiving break. And, of course, the end of the Thanksgiving weekend. I used to always have to drive on that day. I think I've told the story that I was on 9094, that stretch between, say, Toma and Madison, where it's two interstates in one, and everything stopped for hours. It just got gridlocked. It was, again, the combination of deer hunters and students traveling and people at the end of the weekend. Anyway, for Sunday, mostly cloudy with a slight chance for rain or snow and a high of 45 degrees. So not bad. And it's only the slight chance for the precip. And then on Monday, partly sunny with a high of 42. So we gave a little bit of extra attention to the weather with the Thanksgiving period coming up. When we come back after the break, we have a rare circumstance of a sitting judge in one of our local counties facing a challenger. In this case, it's a rather conservative county, and the incumbent is someone who was appointed to the bench by Tony Evers, and he has a challenger who is running as a conservative. And you talk about, well, you need to vet these candidates. You know where that term comes from, vet the candidates? That term vet, turning vet into a verb? Doesn't know where it is. Best we can tell, it's a horse racing term. That if you're going to buy a racehorse, you have a veterinarian check the horse to make sure he doesn't have injuries instead of the other thing, and you vet it out. I'm sure people who buy other animals for purchase probably have to do the same thing. But you never know where these terms precisely come from. But people in horse racing think that we originated it because, you know, you buy a horse, well, you got to vet the horse. Well, you got to vet the candidate. We're going to do our own little bit of vetting, and we'll have that candidate on the program. I'll tell you who he is and what the county is when we come around and do a proper introduction. But that'll be next.
Dave Spano from Annex Wealth.
Standing up for Milwaukee, this is the Mark Belling Late Afternoon Show on News Talk 1130 WYS. And if it sounds like we are now in a never-ending election cycle, it's because we are. But in this case, this isn't even anything new. In Wisconsin, we have spring elections and in fall elections. And the spring elections are the ones in which candidates do not run by political party. They are generally for local and county offices, and occasionally a statewide election, which we will also have this spring, for the state Supreme Court. This means that all local county judicial positions that have contested races are up on the ballot as well. One of the things that I have decried over the years is the number of very liberal judges who get elected in some of our more conservative counties. I think in conservative areas, most of the residents want to have conservative, strong judges. And generally speaking, if there's a contested race and there's a contrast between the two, in the conservative counties, the conservative candidates have tended to win. The Washington County situation is, I won't say unusual, but it's certainly interesting. After a couple of retirements in recent years, we have an interesting phenomenon in that Washington County, which used to be the most Republican county in the state of Wisconsin, got passed by a couple of them in the most recent election, but still a very conservative county. And again, for those of you not in the immediate area, Washington County is West Bend, Slinger, Richfield, that area, Germantown. It's the county that's directly north of Waukesha County. Washington County, a very conservative county. It has four circuit judges on the bench. All four got on the bench after being appointed by Democratic governors. I should explain, in Wisconsin, we elect all circuit judges. However, when there is a vacancy, when someone retires in the middle of their term or moves up to a different position or whatever, when there's a vacancy, all judicial positions are filled by appointment of the governor. And the person who's appointed serves until the next election, in which time they have to face the voters. Often, judges that are appointed don't face a challenger when they run for re-election or they run for a full term on the bench. So you have a situation in Washington County, all four of the judges, one of whom's been on for a long time, was appointed by Doyle. The others more recently appointed by Governor Evers, are on the bench. One of the Evers appointees, Ryan Hetzel, is running for a full term this coming spring. And a prominent local attorney has announced he is running against Hetzel. Hetzel is the Evers appointee. The opposing candidate is local criminal defense attorney Russell Jones, who has been a high-profile lawyer. He's taken on a number of prominent cases. His practice has been based, I believe his law office is in Mequon, but he's done cases in Milwaukee, Ozaukee, and other counties. He's a resident of Washington County, so he's running for Washington County Circuit Judge. We're going to throw a few questions at Attorney Jones in a moment here, but I do want to tell you, as the precursor to all of this, the people who have contacted me on behalf of his campaign have essentially labeled him as conservative candidate Russell Jones. So at least his consultants are presenting Jones as a conservative option to the Evers appointee, Ryan Hetzel. So let's welcome, first of all, let's welcome Russ Jones to the program. Russ, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Okay, as I said, when I was contacted by a couple of people working on behalf of your campaign or who support you, they're using that term, conservative, in describing you in your campaign. Are you willing to embrace that term? And if you are, what does it mean to you? How do you, you know, what makes a judge conservative?
Yeah, I absolutely embrace the label of being conservative. And I think what being conservative means is that somebody that's willing to follow the rule of law and the Constitution and not legislate from the bench. I mean, in short, I've done that my entire career. I've represented people and protected their individual freedom and the Constitution. So I think that that's what a conservative judge should do.
We clearly have frustration from a lot of people in the state of Wisconsin, including me, over people who have been convicted of rather serious, or in some cases, very serious crimes, and the punishment has been, I think, soft, if at all. Without even addressing the juvenile court system, which is an even bigger problem, we have people that have been convicted of serious criminal offenses in adult court, and often they will be given maybe a few months in jail and then a period of extended supervision, or in the case of some violent sex offenses, 1 or 2 years in jail, or in other cases, 3 or 4, in cases in which the statute calls for as much as 20 or 30 years. However, it's also certainly fair to say that not all judges do this. In some cases, it's especially in Milwaukee County, where you have better than 50 circuit judges, it's judicial roulette, where some are known to be strong sentencers and others are known to be soft. I think most people in Washington County don't want lenient judges. On the other hand, we talk about the issue in the abstract. We don't have a case in front of us. Here's criminal A. What would you give him? How do you respond to that question? And where do you put in your philosophy with regard to sentencing? And do you believe we have a problem in Wisconsin right now with too much leniency?
Well, I do think we have a problem in so much that I'm always willing to represent someone and defend their individual rights. The Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment are just as important as the Second Amendment. But once you've been convicted, I think that's when you need to remove these people from the community and remove them for a long period of time. And ultimately, when you have sentences that don't reflect that, I think you're sending a message that we don't take crime seriously, and you see repeat offenders over and over again. I certainly think Washington County residents want that type of judge, and I don't think that my opponent represents that.
Why?
Well, first of all, he's an Evers appointee. Number two, he signed the Walker recall. He's donated several $1,000s to the Evers campaigns over the years. And he also has no criminal experience, or at least very limited criminal experience. So I don't think he really knows how to recognize which criminals need to be put away and which ones don't.
Let's
so based upon that, I, you know.
Go ahead. Finish your answer.
Well, I'm just saying based upon that, I think that he would be certainly leaning towards the liberal side of this, the scale.
One of my biases, and I think it's a fair bias, but it's not one that is impossible for someone to overcome, is obviously you're a criminal defense attorney. Your life's work has been to try to help people, in many cases guilty people, evade punishment. You represent them. Certainly under our system, everyone is entitled to representation, and the Constitution and court rulings have said you not only have right to, you know, representation, but good representation. So I understand you're filling that role. On the other hand, there are a lot of things that you could have done with your life's work. How do you square away your strong stance on crime with the fact that you have worked as a criminal defense attorney and have defended people, I'm sure many of whom have been guilty?
Well, I don't think that what I've done is try to get people off. I think what I've done is protect their constitutional rights. And I think protecting individual rights is a conservative value. And I square that with the fact that those are my clients and that's my job. When I'm elected to the Washington Circuit Court, my clients will be the citizens of Washington County, and my job would be to represent their interests and what they desire, which I believe are conservative values and strong sentencing guidelines to be followed.
I guess when you run for office, you have to start tooting your own horn. I will comment that in talking to some lawyers about you and in doing not much, but some research, you've won a fair number of awards. And when it comes to highly regarded local criminal defense attorneys, you know, like anything else, some people are good, some people are bad, and a lot of people are in between. You've been honored repeatedly as being one of the stronger criminal defense attorneys in southeastern Wisconsin. I'll allow you to talk about that and then generally talk about why you believe you're of enough caliber to be able to be a circuit judge.
Well, thank you, Mark. Yeah, I've been doing this 20 years. I've done several hundred jury trials. I've won awards, I think, for not only winning cases, but also I've had respect from both sides of the aisle. And I think that if you ask district attorneys who have tried cases against me and officers who I've cross-examined, they frequently come up to me and say if they were ever in trouble, they would hire me. So I think that I always have a balance in what I do. And I think what I ultimately try and do is protect the Constitution. I try and protect the rule of law. And I think now it's time for me after 20 years to give back to the community and serve my community. And quite frankly, when I see my community having three Evers appointees, that's troubling to me. And I want to make sure that there's people on the bench in Washington County that reflect the values of the people of Washington County. And I think I do that.
I don't know a lot about your background. I know that you're a resident of Hartford, obviously, in Washington County. Tell us a little bit about, you know, where you grew up, where you're from, and how long have you lived in the county, and, you know, that stuff.
Sure. Actually, I'm a resident of Slinger.
I'm sorry.
I started my law practice in Hartford. That's probably where you got that. Well, look, I was born and raised in Canada, so I'm a Canadian. I immigrated to this country. I came to Wisconsin in 1999 to attend Marquette Law School. I now reside in Washington County. My wife and I have lived there for the last 2 years, but my wife's from the Lamira area, so her entire family's in Washington County and Dodge County, and we've returned to that area. So I've been in Wisconsin for, 24 years, and I went to Marquette Law and stayed here ever since.
And the final area that I want to get into, obviously criminal cases are the highest profile cases that the public sees, but I don't think it's the majority of cases that circuit judges handle in the state of Wisconsin. You're going to get everything under the sun, from divorces to civil litigation to, you know, challenges to any number of cases that would come out there. You've been primarily a trial attorney, and obviously judges deal primarily with litigation work and trial work. Just talk about the broad base of experience that you believe that a judge needs to bring to the table and why you'd be ready to be up and running as a sitting judge.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, first of all, I have handled civil cases. I started my practiced for the first 2.5 years in the insurance defense world. So I've done insurance defense litigation, subrogation. I've handled family cases. I've done estate planning throughout the years. Criminal has been sort of the primary focus of my practice, but I've litigated civil cases and family cases. So I think that I have a broad spectrum of experience that allows me to face all things that a judge would face on the bench.
I have argued that one of our problems throughout all of southeastern Wisconsin is, of all the political offices that we have, the one in which there's almost never opposition is circuit judge. Occasionally when there's a vacancy, or here in your case where someone is appointed and running for the first time, there may be a challenge, but almost all judges, once they get on the bench, never face opposition. So while our state constitution calls for them to be elective offices, if you can serve 30 years and never have an opponent, it really isn't an elective office. Part of the challenge, of course, is incumbents usually win. So challengers figure, what's the point of running and, you know, simply losing? Most of these people win. But I do believe that our system in Wisconsin, which calls for electing judges, is a good one. In this case, I think you've chosen Hetzel to run against, given the fact that you believe that he's, you know, an Evers appointee who's left of center, and you're a resident of a conservative county, and that's the reason you've run. But I do want to talk in general about that whole question that I raise of, clearly, the public has a right to choose, A, who our judges are, and I think the philosophy of the judge is certainly fair game to consider. But when we have all of these races, and Washington County's been notorious for it, in which nobody's ever opposed, the public isn't choosing their judges. Somebody comes on the first time, or judges are simply a tool of whoever happens to control the governor's office, and we're staring now at the prospect of Tony Evers naming judges to every single judicial vacancy in the state over an 8-year period of time. And if all those people simply get elected to full terms, it means the governor is picking a huge percentage of our judges. It's kind of an open-ended question, but I throw it out to you for your thoughts.
Well, I think you're right, Mark. I think the judiciary is a critical piece of the entire government puzzle, and I think, quite frankly, circuit court judges are overlooked, both in Washington County, who I don't think has had really a contested judicial campaign for at least 15 years, but all throughout the state. I think the issue we have is circuit court judges make the decisions that affect probably 90% of the people. And I know that we argue about the Supreme Court frequently, and that gets the high-profile races. But at the end of the day, the circuit court judges are the ones that are making those day-to-day decisions. And I think that's where voters need to come out, and they need to make sure that their judges represent their values in their community. And there needs to be more people challenging judges. I don't know how we change the problem, but I certainly think it is a problem.
Yeah, one of the things that has to happen is incumbents have to start losing for no other reason than people are going to be more willing to run if they think that they have a chance of winning. And it's also probably fair to say, you know, we have 72 counties in the state, and most of the judges that are on the bench are decent enough at their job, and there hasn't been a compelling case to throw them out of office. The other thing is, of course, the term is 6 years, so if you win, is it six years for circuit judge? It is,
yes.
6 years. Yeah, so when you win, you're on for a lengthy period of time. Anyway, I want to thank you for joining us, and whichever way that election, and by I don't know, has anyone else talked about running, or is it simply you and the incumbent Hetzel? Is there?
As far as I know, the candidates obviously aren't set till January 3rd.
And the filing period starts in a couple of weeks in December, right?
Correct. But as far as I know, no one else is running against Ryan other than me.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks for joining us. That's Russ Jones. He's an attorney, and he mentions he's got an office in Hartford. I think he's got one in Mequon. A lot of the attorneys have offices in multiple locations, but he's handled a number of high-profile cases throughout southeastern Wisconsin. While a criminal defense attorney, you heard him make the case that he's a conservative judge, and it would bring a conservative philosophy to the bench. The candidate that he's running against is an incumbent on the basis of having been appointed by Tony Evers, and there was criticism of a recent bail case in which someone released on low bail set by Ryan Hetzel went on to be accused of new crimes. But whichever way it goes, I'm glad there's a contested race in this race, and I wish a lot more of these judges that were put on by Tony Evers over the last now better than 4 years received challenges as well. We've seen the problem in Milwaukee County of Evers appointees in some cases atrocious appointees in which the sentencings and the bails that have been set have been utterly disgraceful, not face no challenge at all. In Milwaukee County, it's bad enough, given the fact that in most contested races between liberals and conservatives, the liberal judge has won. But were it to happen in more conservative counties in the suburbs, or even swing counties like Racine and Kenosha counties, we need to have these elections, and we need to have the candidates at least have a platform to air their differences. There is tremendous frustration, particularly from those of us right of center, of what's going on with regard to the courts and people that are extremely liberal, who have tilted the court system to a point that has gotten to be absurd. And the Brooks case recently highlighted the frustration of this, but there have been zillions of mini Brooks cases over the state for a number of years.
Well, you don't know me.
No, you don't know.
News Talk 1130 WISN. Mark Belling, late afternoon show. Now, here's an interesting story. Let's start with the premise. Should you be able to invest in Bitcoin in your 401k? I didn't ask if it was a good idea. I asked if you should be able to do it. Three Democratic United States senators are asking Fidelity Investments, which is the number two administrator of 401k plans in terms of number of plans held in the United States, to reconsider its decision to allow people within their 401k to invest in Bitcoin or Bitcoin-related instruments, any type of cryptocurrency. The three senators are drawing attention to the recent collapse of the FTX exchange and controversy over other cryptocurrencies and the generally declining values of a lot of the cryptos, and saying that this isn't a good idea, that we shouldn't be encouraging people to use their retirement accounts to invest in things as risky as this. All right, some thoughts. First of all, 401ks can be used for a wide range of investments. The biggest question is simply whether or not the plan administrator is going to allow it. For example, here at our company, we have a plan administrator, and in fact, it is Fidelity, and they give us like a zillion different things that you can invest in, but I don't think Bitcoin is one of them. Our particular plan, either, you know, there's this mutual fund, that mutual fund, a bunch of bond funds, target date funds, money market fund, and so on. But theoretically, you could create a 401k that included other options. Some, for example, include precious metals. Some have specialized funds. Some allow you to invest in derivatives or commodities and so on. The question of Bitcoin has become controversial. Within the past couple of years, many plans have allowed Bitcoin to be an investment placed within the 401k. And a few years prior to that, precious metals became things that you could invest in within a 401k. If people wanted to invest, for example, in gold or in silver, you would be able to do it within the context of a 401k. IRA rules are similar. The little bit of difference there is that within a 401k, you've got somebody administering the plan, and the choice of what you can invest in is up to the administrator. In some cases, employers don't want to give their employees a zillion options, for a lot of reasons. In other cases, they do. In many large companies, they'll give you lots and lots and lots of options because it's a huge company and lots of employees may have different goals for their investing. And in some companies, the plans are more restricted. All right, that's all background. I think that the United States senators are wrong. I don't think that companies that administer benefit plans ought to restrict the ability of people to be able to invest in something like Bitcoin if they want to. But that's an entirely separate question of whether or not it's prudent for someone to do. It seems to me right now that the veil has been pulled back on Bitcoin. It's gone from being trendy to something that people just think is ludicrously stupid. Now, maybe the answer is in between. I don't pretend to know the answer to that. But we know this. We know that Bitcoin is an investment that doesn't seem to be tangible. You've got essentially a digitally created image that someone has assigned a value, and the value is based on essentially what somebody wants to pay for today as opposed to tomorrow. Given the fact that anyone can create a crypto, we went from one or two well-known cryptos like Bitcoin to hundreds of them, new ones created all the time. It's hard for me to see what the value of something is when somebody else can create 10,000 new versions of the same thing tomorrow, and so on. One of the things that gives any type of investment value is how hard it is to find, how rare is it? Even using the example of gold and silver, there is a finite amount of gold and silver in the world. We don't know exactly what it is, people estimate. But there's only so much gold in the world. There's only so much silver in the world. So therefore, it has a value because we only have so much of it around, and in order to get some, you have to buy it. But when something is simply created by somebody going out there and using a lot of electricity and spinning out some digital codes and creating something, the whole point of placing a proper value on it is hard to do. If you buy stock in Microsoft, you can assess the earnings of Microsoft and the holdings of Microsoft and the growth potential of Microsoft and the overall look feel for the American economy. And you may make a bad decision or a good decision, but at least you're basing it on something. But the fact that something might be extremely risky and hard to value doesn't mean that I think we should be out there taking away investment choices from people. Here's the next part of this. There may well be some people who within their 401k want to put one half of 1% of their savings into Bitcoin. That's entirely different than some guy out there who's got $250,000 in a 401k and puts all of it in Bitcoin. Forever and ever and ever, many investment advisors have been saying that people should put maybe 1% to 2% of their savings into something like precious metals, gold, or silver. That it's a hedge, and at 1% or 2%, even if those things go to zero, all you're going to lose is 1% or 2% of your investments. Again, it's an option that you would have out there. So my takeaway on this is, I think for anyone, other than somebody who's really young who doesn't have a lot of money saved anyway, if you want to take a flyer right now, you think that Bitcoin or any of the cryptos are really low, and put $500 in and you're 23 years old, that's not the dumbest thing in the world to do if you could afford to lose the $500. But for people that have saved a significant amount of money and they've worked for a long time to do it, it seems to be right now, especially with people trying to pull their money out of these exchanges, and the fact that the places that the bitcoins are often held in, the currency banks, aren't insured by anyone. In the case of FTX, the money apparently just all gone. Poof. It doesn't exist at all. It's a risky thing to do. But to go out there and have officials of government trying to tell private sector companies that administer these plans that they shouldn't even offer it is a bridge too far. Finally, the next chapter of this. The SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, does not regulate crypto. Now, the people who've been investing in crypto were unbothered by that for quite some time because their whole point of crypto was is that it wasn't something that was regulated or controlled or under the thumb of any kind of government. They kind of like that. But as is the case with just about everything, people like all of this until something goes sour, and then they wonder why somebody else didn't protect them. If something isn't regulated at all, it is buyer beware. And I'm not generally a big fan of government regulation. But do understand that if something is entirely unregulated, you are then on your own. And you really shouldn't be turning around and looking to somebody else or crying to someone and wonder why you weren't protected from your own mistakes if one of the reasons that you got involved in the investment in the first place is that it was unregulated and not controlled by anyone. With regard to any of these things, there are going to be people of high integrity who get involved, and then there's going to be sharks and charlatans who get involved. And I suspect that while not everybody involved in crypto is a shark or a charlatan, that there were a whole lot of sharks and charlatans who figured out that this is a pretty good thing to be able to get into because there's a lot of pigeons out there to be fleeced. 20 years from now, will Bitcoin or any of the cryptocurrencies even exist? Will Bitcoin itself rebound? Will it go back to 100,000, 500,000, or will it be at zero? How many different cryptocurrencies will there be? Will they be anything other than a novelty? Or will they disappear altogether? I don't know. But I do think, while it might be an extremely risky investment, we shouldn't be telling people that they don't have a right to invest in them. Now, I'll grant you this. I don't think that you can simply claim that anything you want to put your money into should be allowed in a 401k. If you want to, for example, claim that you're investing in a rare car, can you put that in a 401k? There's a line that probably has to be drawn somewhere. People have raised questions about a lot of futures, options, whether or not they should be within a 401k. Again, the question is, how much are we going to do to protect people from themselves? The riskier the investment, the greater the opportunity for reward and the greater the opportunity for loss. So I right now, like most people, don't want to have much of anything to do with any of these cryptos. I think I still have money in a Coinbase account. I think it's like $47 that's laying around there to keep the thing open. But the thing right now seems incredibly fraught with peril. And until the dust settles, I don't want any part of it. But to have government officials pressuring private companies like Fidelity to try to tell them what kind of investments ought to be offered, that's going too far in the opposite direction. The one thing that has happened over the last few months, I think you commented on this a few months ago. Remember all those people were bragging about all the money that they made in crypto? You don't hear from those people anymore, do you? Here's the one thing you've never heard. I've never heard a person walk up, you know, I lost $90,000 in crypto. When they make, there's a lot of, it's like people coming back from Las Vegas. You don't get a lot of people saying that, well, some people say, they're honest enough to say they lost their shirt, but people tend to talk about the smart things they do more than the dumb things that they do. Our own company, 401k plan, does not offer a Bitcoin option, but it doesn't offer a lot of things. I generally think that plans should offer, give people a lot of options to do what it is that they want to do. But if you're going to get involved in anything other than a more traditional investment, I don't think you should turn around and say, well, it's your fault for giving me the chance to buy into it. For example, our company's plan does not have any type of real estate investments. A lot of 401k plans do, where you can invest in a real estate fund or something of that nature. We don't have any specialty funds. There's a few stock market funds, value growth, so on. Then these target date funds, bond funds, and so on. And I'm fine with that. I'm glad that we have the option. But I'm, in general, in favor of giving people as many choices as possible. The one thing that you don't want to do is invest in something that you don't understand. Let me go back to about 15 years ago when the housing markets collapsed. There were a number of governmental entities, including several school districts. West Allis was one of them, as you recall, that invested a huge chunk of their money, their investment portfolio, in derivatives that were tied to the housing market. And they all claimed that they were advised by financial advisors to do it, that these were bonds that they were investing in that were very, very low risk because the derivative was tied to hundreds and hundreds of thousands of different mortgages. And the notion was, okay, fine, some people default, but that's such a small percentage of this portfolio. But a derivative isn't something that's actually invested in anything. It's simply matching what all of those mortgages would do. The only way that those investments would go sour is if the entire housing market collapsed and therefore there were massive defaults in mortgages. Well, that's what happened. And a lot of those funds went bust and they crashed almost down to zero. The losses were 60, 70, 80, and 90%. And some of those governmental bodies lost a lot of money. They sued their financial advisors. And my retort to all of this is, these business managers of the school districts, what in the world were they doing investing government funds in bond derivatives created like this that they didn't understand? These are the types of things that people should be investing in as speculators if they want to risk their own money. But to have public money being put into something that esoteric, an investment literally created just so everybody can get into the housing market, and clearly, in retrospect, something that seems to have been a stupid investment didn't seem so at the time that they were created. While I believe that a broad base of investments ought to be allowed for people to invest in, it doesn't mean that it's responsible for people, particularly governments, to be investing in most of them. There. Do you have any thoughts on this? If we had in our 401k and a Bitcoin thing, would you put any money in it? Paul said he bought 10,000. What did you still have it? No. Did you sell it for a loss? Little bit. People lie about this. Little bit. It's like the gambling thing. Little bit means quite a bit usually. If somebody comes back from Vegas and said they broke even, that means they lost money. If somebody comes back in Vegas and said they killed it, it means that they made a little bit of money. If somebody doesn't say anything at all, those are the ones that actually made a fortune and they don't want anybody to know about it because they're afraid you'll be hit up for money. A little bit. Well, I mean, I've argued forever that everybody should have a percentage of their savings in precious metals, which have done nothing for several years. It's possible that as the markets continue to, if we move toward recession or worse, if inflation gets worse, maybe at some point they take off. But there's nothing wrong with using a portion of the money that you have to use as a hedge, whether it be real estate, precious metals, or anything else. Some of this stuff, though, you better be able to make a more compelling case than, well, everybody else is doing it. And that's the thing that fueled crypto. And that's the thing that fueled people putting money into these exchanges without really having any knowledge of who it was that was operating the exchange. Look at FTX. Have you seen? Oh, my goodness. Look who's on the TV right now. Paul, I'm telling you, this happens to us twice per show. I'll be talking about a topic, and all of a sudden, Fox will put up a picture of the very person. I was about to say, look at Sam Bankman-Fried, and there's his photo on my monitor. I mean, this guy's like 32 years old, a goof. He's running around buying houses in the Bahamas, all this stuff. He's giving tens of millions of dollars to Democratic political candidates, running around wearing shorts the entire time. This is who you're trusting all of your money to? As much money as they took in and as much investment as they had, billions, he managed to blow through all of it. Do you know how hard it is to blow through $5 billion? You have to think for a moment about how much money that is. You could buy a house for, if you're worth $5 billion, you could buy a house for $100 million. And that would be, what, 2% of your net worth. This is what he blew through. He blew through billions of dollars. Again, it's easy to say in retrospect, look at that goof. Who would have been dumb enough to trust their money to in an uninsured investment to him and say, okay, fine, you sit on all of my crypto. I'm perfectly happy to have it in your exchange. That's the other thing, though. After somebody's been exposed as a con man and a fraud, they always look like con men and frauds. I mean, before this, you would have just said he's, you know, another Mark Zuckerberg or another Bill Gates, a guy that's made a fortune and doesn't have to dress up. What the problem is? Do you know what the problem is? With what? Well, that's a good question. You know the problem with all the Christmas music being played before Thanksgiving? Well, yeah, but you know what the problem with that is, or the reason that that problem exists? The problem with it is there is no Thanksgiving music. If you could like play Thanksgiving music for 3 weeks, at least you would then have an option for the people that start everything prematurely. Other than like Over the River and Through the Woods and a couple of novelty songs, you would have thought that, you know, a few people would have come up for that. Maybe they never figured that there'd be a need, that we need to have some sort of, but I mean, there's even some Easter songs. There just isn't much about Thanksgiving. And I mean, there's a lot of movies and TV shows and sitcoms that have been. What do you think the most famous was? I think there was a Mary Tyler Moore about Thanksgiving where they couldn't get the turkey done. And then was it Seinfeld that had the food fight? I think it was. You know everything about Seinfeld. Didn't they have a food fight in Seinfeld? Yeah, I know that there was the WKRP turkey drop. Wasn't there a food fight in Seinfeld? Am I thinking of the Mary Tyler Moore food fight? Yeah. Seinfeld didn't have you would know. You've watched every Seinfeld. It would be amazing if somehow you've watched all of them 27 times and you missed that one, that there was a gap in there. I mean, everything that ever happens in life you come up with, there's a Seinfeld for that. They didn't have a Seinfeld food fight? Was there a Cheers food fight? Am I thinking of that? I think that's what it was. I think there was a Cheers food fight. But we lack music on this. From that to Hunter Biden. Now let's start with this. This is an extraordinarily weird development. This past Monday, CBS News reported that the Hunter Biden laptop has been verified to be legitimate. 769 days after the New York Post report came out, the CBS News is now verifying the legitimacy of the Hunter Biden laptop. Everybody in the world has pretty much acknowledged that the Hunter Biden laptop was legitimate, that this wasn't Russian disinformation, that it was his laptop, and that everything on there is something that he put on it. But CBS News did report Monday that they verified it. So the question is, why? You know, they wrongly reported that it was disinformation and that there was no reason to believe it was credible 2 years ago, and they've been trying to debunk it ever since. But why come out and essentially throw this out there now? In the past, I would argue that motivations aren't important. Let's just consider the story. But the motivations of the media are now as important to understand as the story itself. As I've been telling you with regard to every news story you ever read or you ever see or whatever the format is, ask yourself why it's in there. After all this time, and now that the midterm elections are over, there is at least some level of interest in the media on all of the salacious things in the Hunter Biden laptop, and in particular on this particular issue of whether or not Joe Biden was personally involved in Hunter's dealings and whether or not Joe Biden may have been benefiting from some of Hunter Biden's illegal activity. A, was Joe talking about and discussing with Hunter the criminal behavior he was involved in? And B, was he getting any of the money? Now, I have a theory. I'm not the only one with this theory. A lot of people have it. Some simply believe that now that the Republicans control the House and that there will be an aggressive congressional investigation with subpoenas, that a lot of dirt is going to come out. Or it may simply be that the ongoing investigations have produced so much that it's getting so close to Biden that CBS and the others recognize they now have to, after being behind on this story, not get out in front of it, but at least acknowledge it. In other words, that something very, very bad is about to drop on the Bidens. And the media, in order to regain some credibility, need to have at least acknowledged at some point that the original thing that started to blow the scandal up was in fact real. That's my theory. My theory is that the Hunter Biden laptop story is about to give us pretty strong proof of Joe Biden being in on this. And now that the midterms are over and a whole lot of Democrats don't want Joe to run for re-election in 2024, that there's no particular need to protect Biden anymore. Anyway, they're now asking about Joe's knowledge of Hunter's dealings in these briefings that Karine Jean-Pierre is holding at the White House. Now, first of all, Karine has a very difficult job, and very few people are very good at just being able to lie through their teeth when being asked these questions. Jen Psaki was very good at it. I go back to the first scandal in my lifetime in which I saw a presidential spokesman being peppered every day. It was back when I was a kid, when Ron Ziegler was Richard Nixon's press secretary. And Ron Ziegler, you know, he was a younger version of Nixon. He had the shadows under his eyes and dark, and he was one of these guys that right after he shaved, he'd still look like he needed a shave. And he'd be up there in the perfectly tailored suit and the tie up there, and very aggressive, and he'd pounce back at the reporters, and he would throw the questions back at them. And he was obviously defending the indefensible. Nixon wasn't telling the truth. But Ziegler at least could put sentences together to be able to tell essentially what was the lie. I want you to listen. You think Joe mangles his words? Well, we understand why Joe mangles his words. We also sort of understand why Kamala mangles her word. This is the press secretary. She's specifically chosen for her ability to put words together. The question that's put to KJP, Karine Jean-Pierre, deals with the president's knowledge of Hunter Biden's business dealings. Listen to this response.
Can you address whether the president was involved in any of his son, Hunter, or his brother's foreign business dealings?
So look, there's a little bit of interesting you know, kind of on-brand thinking here, because, congressional Republicans ran saying that they were going to fight inflation. They said they were going to make that a priority. They were very clear about that these past several months. And instead, what they're doing is they're focusing, they're making their top priority. They get the majority, and their top priority is actually not focusing on the American families, but focusing on the president's family.
First of all, I don't really know what on-brand thinking is. The first 20 seconds of that, can you play it again? The first 20 seconds of the answer. First of all, she knows this question's coming. They now know what's coming. Everything's changed. They're going to be asked about what the president knew and whether or not he benefited from Hunter and the brother, Jim Biden, what it was that they were doing. They know that the question is there. She knew it had to be coming, yet she's so terrified of herself lying and putting herself in a position in which they can say that she said something dishonest that she has to avoid the question. So for 20 seconds, you have a disconnected stream of thought of a bunch of words, and then she just runs around and says, well, Republicans shouldn't be asking about this in the first place without even addressing it. Listen to her first 20 seconds.
Can you address whether the president was involved in any of his son, Hunter, or his brother's foreign business?
Now, what she could say, were it true, is, no, he wasn't. Which is what Joe Biden's been saying all along. Notice that she can't say that because they know that he was. So rather, Joe was involved in every one of the crimes that Hunter and Jim was involved in. Joe, our president of the United States, is up to his eyeballs in all of this crap. She can't say no, and she can't say yes. So this is the best she can come up with.
So look, there's some a little bit of interesting. Kind of on-brand thinking here, because congressional Republicans
Now we can stop. A kind of on-brand thinking here. Maybe that is some sort of term in Washington lingo for something or another. On-brand thinking. What does that have to do with that guy and his question about? So anyway, everything I read indicates that this story has made a turn, and right now, Joe Biden is of no use to the Democrats at all, and what with the midterm elections over, what do they care about Joe Biden? Their highest priority is getting reelected in 2024, and I think that it's dawned on them that they don't want Joe Biden to be their candidate, so a lot of the stuff from the media and a lot of their takes on these stories may be very, very different. You have a theory. Paul has a theory. Should we, play a special sounder for your theory? Paul thinks starting at tomorrow, nobody's going to give a crap about news until next week, Monday, so you think a lot of things are going to be snuck in during that point of time? Yeah, I'm just of the opinion that you're going to start to see some prominent Democrats join in the calls for an investigation of the Hunter thing because they want to ease Biden out. I mean, the far left wing of the party never much liked him. The ones that simply are concerned about being reelected, where are they coming from? Now take also, you've got two or three Democrats, including Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, who want to run for president. You think Gavin Newsom wouldn't love to see this story get out there? There are a lot of Democrats now who have a vested interest in pushing the very story that we've been told for 2 years wasn't true. That story now suddenly can, conveniently for them, become de facto true. Standing up for Milwaukee, this is the Mark Belling Late Afternoon Show on News Talk 1130 WISN. An interesting story from the world of business here to start this segment. You know, when you think about it, there have been quite a few Wisconsin companies that have sort of just come out of nowhere over the last, the last half century or so, that went on to become, really big things. Some have been here forever, and there's still Wisconsin companies like SC Johnson, the consumer products company based in Racine. There have been other companies that are newer. One of the most interesting, though, because you don't really see it replicated anywhere, is Quick Trip. Don Zietlow, who has run Quick Trip for 52 years, is retiring at the end of the year. been with the company for that entire time. The last 22 has been president. He's been in top management throughout. Name the convenience store and gasoline chain around here most similar to Quick Trip. Paul says Speedway. I think that's a reach because I don't think any of them are really similar to Quick Trip. I mean, the Speedway stores are similar in that they tend to be very large, and most Quick Trip stores are really, really, really large. You know, I go around the country and almost every convenience store that I see, the big chains, you know, there's the 7-Elevens and then there's a bunch, you know, there's a bunch of the others, and they all kind of all seem the same to me. And the one thing that you never hear associated with any of them is like high quality food. Quick Trip has their own commissary. They prepare all of their food, you know, not like the can of soup and so on, but the stuff that you buy fresh is all prepared in-house. They don't buy from anybody else. They've created this image of being a high-end convenience store, yet they sell the gas for the same low price that all the other convenience stores do. Paul carries on. Their chicken is amazing. Now, think about that. That's my point about that. I questioned the Speedway comparison. Can you think of any other, like, convenience store chain that's known for the quality of their great food? The thing that I find, you know, interesting about Quick Trip is clearly Quick Trip still is predominantly an upper Midwest chain. They continue to expand around the country, but first it was Western Wisconsin, then it was Wisconsin, then Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa, and it continues to expand and continues to expand. When somebody does something that works, and Quick Trip is obviously incredibly popular in Wisconsin, which is why they're able to justify having all these locations, some not that far from one another, that you'd think that everybody else would like try to copy it. Yet there are hardly any exact imitators of Quick Trip, and I suspect the reason that the others haven't been able to do it is they can't figure out how to make money doing it. For instance, Paul says the chicken is amazing. In order to have amazing chicken, you got to put a fair amount of money into that, and most convenience store operators figure out it's probably really hard to have high quality chicken and still sell it at a profit margin in which we can make money. And when you think about convenience stores, most people think of the stuff that they buy there as they're buying it for convenience. It's good enough. Quick Trip created this thing that our stuff's going to be like better than everybody else's is, but we're still going to have all the things a convenience store has. You're still going to have a zillion pumps. You're still going to have all the junk that you get at a convenience store. You're still going to have, at almost all of them, a car wash with maybe one or two bays in there. You're going to have all of those things, but if you want to buy the food, the coffee apparently is right up there near the top. Now, there are a few convenience store chains that are known for having great coffee. That's an obvious thing to kind of master because people want to run in and grab the whole thing. But the philosophy behind Quick Trip was, I mean, I think that they've invented a market niche that nobody else has even moved into yet, which is to have very high-end convenience stores with very high level of customer service, and the food is of very high quality. The other thing, in an era of just everybody has employee shortages and the gas stations and all these places are the same as everyone else, Quick Trip is just known. They have people who've worked, go anywhere in the state of Wisconsin. I can't speak about Quick Trips in other parts, in other states. There'll be people in there. I've worked for Quick Trip for 20 years. I've worked there for 25 years. I've worked there for 30 years. They have incredible loyalty among their employees who just, it's become like, you wouldn't think that a convenience store is a place that you would brag that you work at. But people who work at Quick Trip are proud that they work at Quick Trip. I'm not knocking any of the others. It's just not part of the nature of, you know, low-end customer service type work that people would be bragging that they work at those places. Yeah, well, you're right. Now, I suspect that they're, and I don't know all of this, I suspect that their pay scale is higher than that of their competitors, which is so that they're able to get employees who are polite and friendly and all of that stuff. But they're able to then do that, and still the gas is usually at the same price as everything else. I don't know if you go to Speedway or the others, if like the gallon of milk is 6 cents more at Quick Trip or not, but evidently it's at least close enough that they remain highly popular. Anyway, my history on this is, as you all know, I went to La Crosse, and Quick Trip's from La Crosse. when I went to UW La Crosse, there were just a few Quick Trips in town, and they were the only ones that existed in the company. They had a couple down the interstate in Sparta, and they had one in Tomah and a couple in La Crosse. And we just, when the Quick Trips started, they weren't the nice things that they are now. They were just convenience stores. But they became popular, maybe because there were roots in the community as opposed to the other gas stations just, okay, we sell gas here and let's put in some cigarettes and a few things as a sidelight. The other thing I think of with Quick Trip is that logo has never changed. That logo that they have now is virtually identical to the one that was on those stores when I went to college. Quick Trip's been an important force in business in the state of Wisconsin. A fair number of the leaders have been contributors to Republican causes in the state. They've gotten a little bit of criticism for that over the years. The actual first location for Quick Trip was in Eau Claire, even though the company has been primarily based in La Crosse most of its time. So anyway, Don Ziegler retired at the end of the year. The next story, we broke a record over the weekend. The most money ever paid for a Green Bay Packers Super Bowl I ring. Fuzzy Thurston's ring, which has long since not been Fuzzy Thurston's ring because Fuzzy Thurston is no longer with us, has been owned by a couple of people in the interim, and it went on sale at Heritage Auctions over the weekend and drew a price of $216,000, which is a record. It's not a record for a Super Bowl ring. It's a record for a ring from Super Bowl I, the very first Super Bowl. And, of course, a lot of Packers from that era have rings from the first and the second Super Bowl because Green Bay won the both of them. Anyway, the record had been a Dave Robinson's ring, which Dave sold a few years ago for $174,000. The Fuzzy Thurston ring went for $216,000. The person who put it up for bid at Heritage had, what's the term? I think a reserve. Yeah, a reserve. A reserve is the price that if it doesn't get to that price, it doesn't sell. And the bidders usually don't know what that price is. We do that in the horse auction business all the time. For instance, let's suppose you want to get at least $500,000 for your horse. You'll set a reserve of $500,000. And if the bidding stops at $400,000, the person with the high bid doesn't win. They just didn't get high enough and you didn't sell your horse. That happens all the time. It happens in the art world as well. The person who put the ring up apparently set a reserve of $100,000, and it took 10 minutes to get to $100,000. But then once it crossed the reserve, it kept on going and got to the $216,000. All right. Championship rings, they become kind of ubiquitous. I'm not sure of this, I think the Super Bowl started this. I don't know if they've been given out since the 30s and the 40s in baseball. I think the Super Bowl was when the concept of rings started. But now there's a World Series ring. You win the NBA championship, you get a ring. The ring ceremony's a big deal, and so on. But I think the Super Bowl started this entire trend. Here's what we know about the Super Bowl rings. There's obviously a finite number of them because we know which members of the Packer team and organization and coaches got them. So there's a limited number of them. Secondly, while you can forge anything, given the fact that all of these rings were given to a specific player, it's pretty easy to be able to go back and prove whether or not this is the actual Fuzzy Thurston ring or this is the Bart Starr ring, etc. Thirdly, there aren't a lot of them in circulation because most of them remain in the families of the original Packers. So having said all of that, doesn't it seem to you that this is cheap? When you think about, people are paying millions of dollars for somebody's baseball rookie card. Well, that's just a card, and there might only be one known and exists. There might only be, say, one Lou Gehrig rookie card from the 1930s or whatever it is. But it's still just a card, and it's still just one company. Each of these players only got one ring. Furthermore, it was the first Super Bowl. This isn't like Super Bowl 26. When you just see all these things that are out there selling for a fortune, I mean, I'm not somebody that's ever into the notion of collectibles, but I think a ring from, if I was going to want to collect something, I think a ring from Super Bowl I would be almost like at the top of the list, right? Name another piece of sports memorabilia that you'd rather have than a Super Bowl I ring. Like a record set, like the actual ball that was hit or something. Yeah, I mean, like, or from the Super Bowl, if they had a ball from the game that day, and so on, anything where it's really limited, maybe that ball, you're right. But, it, you know, also, as a Packer fan, and it was the first Super Bowl, and I'm just surprised that some zillionaire hasn't paid, and we don't know what they've sold for on the private market. This is the highest known at auctions. When we talk about the most ever sold for, the most known sold at public auction, it may well be that some player, you know, 25 years ago sold one for $500,000 privately, and no one knows who they are. The little bit that I've read about this is that when they are sold, though, the person does want it immediately to be known, and they have some independent people go out and certify that this is the actual one. In other words, if I bought the ring from, you know, Ken Bowman, I'd want to have some record that I have Ken Bowman's ring to prove that it is if I ever wanted to resell it. We're going to have I often will do this in the 5 o'clock hour. Play a little bit of music when there's a story to tell. Well, we have a little bit of music to play, and there's quite a story to tell. I think this story deals with the actual moment in time that rock and roll entered the mainstream. I'll explain when we come back after a break. What does that mean when you put up that thing that says, like, pill or null on there? I can't read anymore. It means the phone is ringing. And the reason it's always up there is because you never... Oh. Well, what does it even say? It's hard for me to read. Oh, it's just symbols. Well, that's why I was trying to read it. It's just symbols. And now it's gone because the person gave up figuring that Dink Paul isn't going to answer my phone. It's probably somebody who has one of these Super Bowl rings who's now offering to sell it to me, and it's probably a complete rip-off. I think I'd be hard to rip off. I'm just so cynical. I mean, I've told the story about when I was a kid. Somebody took me to Bradford Beach, and I got conned by somebody playing three-card Monty, and whatever naivete I had in life, that was purged then. I haven't trusted anybody about anything since then. Well, the cards were bent. I didn't know. I mean, I have such a con. I'm down here at Bradford Beach. The city slickers are taking advantage of me, and... What do I know? We were honest up there. I wasn't prepared for you sharks in Milwaukee. Yeah, I think they could con you right now. I think they could take you to Bradford Beach. They'd be playing three-card money, and you'd put your $20 right on down there. Yeah, you become cynical because you've, A, worked on this show, and, B, look at the number of... Look at the crap that the left has thrown at us just in the last 5 to 10 years. How can you not be cynical? The Hunter Biden laptop is Russian disinformation. Oh, no, 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 no. COVID didn't come out of the Wuhan lab, even though they were working on the COVID virus there, and the first place it was known to show up was Wuhan. News Talk 1130 WISN, Mark Belling, late afternoon show. One of the things that Paul and I agree upon is that the TV show, the TV series Mad Men is one of the greatest shows in television history. And it's great for a lot of reasons. First of all, it was a great story. It was great acting. But it had like two or three things that kind of underlined the program. And you didn't know this at the beginning because, you know, when a show starts, you don't know how long it's going to last. But because the show was a hit, the producer could carry out his vision from beginning to end. And the vision was to do a story about life in the 1960s. Which somebody who started the 1960s as a tiny little kid and ended it, you know, kind of growing up. I just thought that was regular old life. It's looked back upon as being perhaps the most revolutionary decade in American history, with the possible exception of the actual revolutionary decade of the 1770s, when we had the Revolutionary War and helped found a country. When the 1960s started, America was still a very, you know, it was the decade after the 50s, a straight-laced country. And at the end of the decade, we were in utter turmoil. The people who looked one way at the beginning of the decade looked completely different at the end of the decade. And it was mirrored by a lot of things, the civil rights movement, the space race trying to get to the moon, rioting on the streets, the advent of rock and roll, all the assassinations that were going on. It was the decade of assassinations. People were being killed right and left. Assassinations, political assassinations now are, thankfully, very, very rare. All this stuff went on. And underlying all of it was kind of the dawn of rock and roll. Now, I still remember when I was a kid, the first rock and roll you were exposed to was there were stations that were playing top 40 music, and I, like every other kid, started to listen to it. And the only place you could ever hear it would be on those few radio stations, or you could buy a record. And there were like two TV shows that would play rock and roll. One of them was American Bandstand with Dick Clark, and there were a couple of others. That, it was like something called Shindig and so on. But here's the thing. None of the grown-ups knew anything about it. I think that there were two things that brought rock and roll to the mainstream. One, the Ed Sullivan Show. Ed Sullivan ran this variety show that was on CBS at 7 o'clock on Sunday nights. And he was the first one to constantly bring rock performers. I mean, he brought on Elvis back in the 1950s, and everybody remembers how he brought on the Beatles, but he had the Stones and everybody else. Otherwise, the rest of Ed Sullivan's show, you know, Henny Youngman and all the other stay-at-old mainstream acts that would appeal to older people back in that era. But he introduced a lot of those people to rock and roll. And I think that the other thing that took rock and roll from something that only kids were aware of and took it into the mainstream was the musical Hair. Now, again, I'm a kid, and you don't get exposed to a lot of things, and most of the news that you get is in the mainstream media. And I still remember that for 2 years, the only thing I knew about Hair was that they got on the stage and they were naked. That was like the scandalous thing. But let's start with that. Prior to Hair on Broadway, there was nothing on Broadway like that. Broadway was essentially, think about what they're running now at, what's the city in Missouri? Branson. Broadway, you know, it was like high-end theatrical plays and, you know, musicals like Cabaret and that stuff. There's no such thing as rock and roll at all on Broadway. Hair played on Broadway. The reason for bringing this up today is the guy who produced Hair, the guy who was the driving force behind Hair, his name was Michael Butler. He died a couple of days ago at the age of 95 years old. But he was the guy who essentially created Hair. Broadway and rock and roll were separate worlds. Hair went to Broadway, became this massive hit, and I think it was when rock and roll began transitioning from, okay, this latest fad that goofy kids are listening to the dominant musical form in America. I think that that's when the transition occurred, when this was all mainstreaming itself. Things happened that you never would have thought. In fact, I had a memory, and I Googled it to see if I was right about this. Princess Anne, who would have been young then, would have been 1970, I think. At the end of Hair, what they would do, you know, the closing song in Hair was Let the Sunshine In, and which was the anthem at the end of the thing. And they invited audience members to get up on stage. And Princess Anne got on the stage during a London performance of Hair. And this was like unbelievably shocking that a member of the royal family would get up on stage and dance with this hippie, revolutionary, rebellious kind of thing. Well, when the royal family was doing it, I guess it meant that rock and roll had now arrived. Musically, in terms of the storyline, I remember the first time I heard the soundtrack of Hair, which is probably when I was in high school. You know, the record that had the soundtrack was a big hit. There was no coherent story at all. It was basically, you know, the notion of hair. If you knew that somebody was into rock and roll, they had long hair. If they were somebody that was kind of left of center and rebellious, they had long hair. Long hair or short hair kind of defined whether or not you were part of, like, whatever this new thing was or it wasn't. So that was the title of it. But it tried to poke at every sacred cow that was out there, like race, sex, etc. Most of the music was rather trite. And I don't think it stands up very well. Here's the other thing. Lots of songs from Hair became hits, but they were all covered by mainstream acts. All of them. Good Morning Starshine. Was it Good Morning Starshine? I think that was done by Oliver. The song Hair itself was covered by a band called, I think it was the Cowsills, which became, they were the band that was the inspiration for the Partridge Family. The Fifth Dimension did two songs and combined them into one, Aquarius and Let the Sunshine In. All of the songs were like kind of okay, but the point of Hair wasn't what the music was. It was this statement of this notion of the world is changing, we are in your face, and here you are. So anyway, I pulled out three songs, a couple of which aren't the most famous ones ever to come from Hair that I thought gave you a pretty good feel for it. The first one's called Manchester, England.
England, England, across the Atlantic Sea. And I'm a genius, genius. I believe in God. And I believe that God believes in cloud. That's me.
of Bukowski. Finds that it's groovy to hide in a movie. Pretends it's Fellini and Antonioni. And also his countryman Roman Polanski. All rolled into one. One called Hooper Bukowski. Now that I've
those are all cultural references thrown into the lyrics.
Life dreary, dreary. Answer my weary query.
All right, the next one I have, you've probably heard, especially if you're over the age of 40. It's still played on a lot of oldie stations. And again, it was made a hit by somebody who covered it. You knew the song before that. Before I played it here, right? You heard Easy to Be Hard. Yeah, Paul said, you didn't know Manchester, England, did you? Because, oh, really? You would only know that one if you bought the soundtrack. Paul said his mom played the soundtrack album when he was growing up. I mean, that's the sad thing. She's probably closer to my generation than your generation. Paul said she's 82. Well, I'm about 97. All right. The second one is Easy to Be Hard. And again, the point of the song. And again, the songs are sort of amateurish in their lyrics, kind of clever, but nobody's going to say that the music from Hair had, you know, it wasn't Bob Dylan's lyrics or anything like that, and the music wasn't cutting edge like the Rolling Stone or the Who or others. It was simply the fact that this celebration of whatever this new revolution was now on Broadway. While Broadway is in New York, Broadway really is middle America when you think of it and you think of who the audiences were. So this is Easy to Be Hard. And again, all this stuff is sort of along the lines of peace, love, rock and roll. We have to have a different world. Why? And in this song, it's basically, why is everybody such a big dink? Some of this is from the long obituary of Michael Butler in the New York Times. The only thing he'd promoted before he took Hair to Broadway was polo matches. Where did he get his money from? He's part of the family of Butler Aviation, originally from Chicago. You've all heard of Butler Aviation. Well, that's where he got his money from. He didn't create Hair. Hair was actually playing off Broadway in, you know, some small theater in New York in 1967. And the original version was kind of like the Beatniks, if you think of that generation, sort of more 50s. And he thought that there was potential here, but Butler thought, you know, the Beatniks, they're downers. They're always stoned. He wanted to make it a celebration. He wanted to make it upbeat. And that was the change that he put into it as he financed bringing it to Broadway, and the original drafters of the score and so on, they didn't like his changes because they liked the original notion. And he said that this shouldn't be a downer, that this should be an upbeat celebration of life. That's what we're going to make it. Most Broadway shows are known for having a showstopper. And while Hair produced a lot of hits, I think it's fair to say that the showstopper was the last song of the show, which is Let the Sunshine In, which is when they would invite members of the audience to join everybody on stage. Let the Sunshine In became a hit, covered by the Fifth Dimension, who took two songs from here that are in different parts of the show, Aquarius, or Age of Aquarius, and Let the Sunshine In. But in the show itself, Let the Sunshine In is simply the showstopper, which happened to be the thing that ended the program with everybody on stage. And here's the Broadway version of Let the Sunshine In.
We starve, look at one another, short of breath, walking proudly in our winter coats, wearing smells from laboratories, facing a dying nation of moving paper fantasy, listening for the new told lies, with supreme visions of lonely tunes. Somewhere inside something there is a rush of greatness. Who knows what stands in front of our lives? I fashion my future on films in space. Silence tells me secretly everything.
Frame of reference was hearing all of this stuff as a kid, and this was therefore my music, and the moms and dads, that was still before, oh, that's rock and roll, this, that, and the other thing. And as I say, then it's Broadway, and then all of a sudden people in middle America, Paul said his mom was listening to it, and rock and roll went from being this alternative thing to being the kind of music that was played all over the radio, and then rock broke off into all of these adventurous things, hard rock, acid rock, bubblegum rock, and so on. But I do think that Hair is the moment in time that you might be able to point to. I'd say that and the Beatles and Ed Sullivan as the two moments in which rock and roll went from being this thing that was like kids' music to becoming this giant cultural force in America. Think about the message of all of that stuff. Boy, oh boy, I just seem to me that's all the stuff and all the themes that we conservatives are saying now and railing against the oppression and the stifling of thought and being told that we don't have our freedoms to do much of anything. 60 years ago, when people were railing against the man, they were railing against an authoritarian man that wouldn't let them do what they wanted to do or think the way they wanted to think or look the way they wanted to look. And who is it now that's trying to make us conform to their way of thinking? It's the left, the intellectual heirs of the people who brought about the revolution in the first place. So anyway, Michael Butler didn't go on to do lots of things after that, but will forever known as the guy who wrote the checks. That's what he did, and that's what Broadway has always been. The person who wrote the checks is the person who pulled the whole thing off. There are a few people that wrote the book and the score and pretty much long forgotten, but here. So your mom listened to that stuff, huh? Well, and like, and as I say, I thought "Let the Sunshine In" was a great song. But other than that, a lot of the songs were sort of trite and a little bit simplistic, maybe sort of adventurous. But they were good enough that quite a few of them became hits. But I think the real significance was not of whether or not the music stands up, but the fact that hair happened. And of course, after that, then. Well, yeah, there, all those came after that. Jesus Christ Superstar, which was actually considered a rock opera. The Who Did Tommy and zillions of those things kind of all came afterwards. But by then, well, you could do that because rock and roll was part of the mainstream. And doing a rock anything was legitimate because rock was the dominant form of music that was out there. But prior to Hair, it was still, you know, Dean Martin was still a bigger thing than the Beatles in that era. Not that Dean Martin ever stopped being a big thing, but pretty much after that point, I'd say from about 1967 on, the biggest stars in music were either in rock and roll or country music, and the rest of the people were, you know, that was mom and dad's music. News Talk 1130 WISN, Mark Belling, late afternoon show, and a show that's been filled with changes of pace, another change of pace. There are some people who are now questioning why, given the fact that there were two separate mass murders of college students almost exactly at the same time in different parts of the country. One became a major America news story and the other has been barely noticed. Now, I never know why some of these sensational crimes become huge stories and others are barely forgotten. The story that we had, obviously, in Waukesha is a huge story here because, again, for obvious reasons, it was here. There has been extensive media coverage of the killing of three University of Virginia football players by a former football player there. But there has been very little, relatively speaking, coverage of the murder of four college students at the University of Idaho in Moscow, Idaho. That case is different in that the attacker has not been caught, and in fact, the authorities are acknowledging they don't have a suspect. In the Idaho case, somebody in the middle of the night broke into a home that had six people in it and stabbed four female college students to death and has gotten away. Authorities have not recovered the weapon. Obviously, it was a stabbing, so there's not a gun. They have not recovered the weapon. They don't have a motive, and they don't have a suspect. Yet the authorities say the crime itself was sloppy, but they haven't figured out who did it. There isn't any DNA that they found yet that they've been able to identify. They say that the nature of the crimes would indicate that he likely knew at least one of the women that he killed, given the brutality of the number of stab wounds that were inflicted. As for the brazenness of it, to go into a house that you know that has a lot of people armed not with a gun but with a knife, to have to systematically one after the other kill them, again, a rather brazen crime. As for why the guy busting into the house and killing four female college students in Idaho has gotten far less coverage than somebody killing three football players in Virginia, I don't really know. The numbers of victims are similar. If anything, the case in Idaho would speak more to the kind of case that cable news channels like to cover because there's the mystery. We don't know who did it. Yeah, Paul mentions the stalker thing. In fact, two of them had stalkers, and they were separate stalkers. One had an extensive stalker. Was that person it? Again, they're not really sure. But this number of days later, you'd think, and with regard to a lot of these crime stories that occur from other parts of the country, if they don't raise larger issues in society of, you know, somebody who's free on bail or something or another, you know, it's just more crime in a country that right now has all sorts of crime, but there have been a lot of commentators have been questioning, you know, and some people are saying it's sexism. In one case, it was males. The other case, it was females. Some people said there's a racial component. The victims in Idaho were white, whereas some of the victims in Virginia were African American. I don't know what the distinction is, and I've never really been, other than, you know, when you've got like a JonBenet Ramsey thing or a Casey Anthony, when there's like an attractive female involved, it's always hard for me to figure out which of these sensational murder cases become newsworthy and which do not. For example, in the city of Chicago, four people being killed in a weekend wouldn't even merit any attention whatsoever. College students doing nothing wrong, simply being murdered in their home, is a big deal. So have you been following the story at all? What have you picked up on it? On the Idaho story, yeah. You've been following it. Paul says, well, and, you know, the other situation is Virginia's close to a major metropolitan area. I mean, you're out there in the state of Idaho. Now, Moscow, Idaho is a college town. It's not a small city. On the other hand, I don't think, when you think of like high level forensic agencies, you don't think of them being in Idaho, but it's also not the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's a college town, and a large University of Idaho is a pretty big university and so on, but you kind of think they're all commenting that this seems to be an amateurish kind of crime. On the other hand, they haven't caught him and they've not identified a suspect. They don't have anybody whose picture they're willing yet to put up and say, hey, if you know where this guy is, be on the lookout for him. Yeah, it's the thing. Paul mentions they left the doors open, unlocked, and chances are this is somebody who knew at least one of the victims because he knew he'd be able to get in. And again, I've not been to Moscow, Idaho, but I can't imagine any college campus. Never mind murder. I just wouldn't trust that somebody wouldn't be coming in to do something or another. University of Idaho. Again, it's just a tragic story. And the number of wingnuts. And again, if it's somebody who's a stalker or somebody who's obsessed, I struggle for why we seem to have an increase in the number of people that are obsessed. There have always been people that are stalking. Always people that have this level of obsession. Everything just seems to be worse. It must have something to do with the internet and all the fantasies that people come up with based on the stuff that they see on the web. Either that or, again, just the solution, our standard solution, they're all screwed up on drugs. News Talk, 1130 WISN, Mark Belling, late afternoon show. Two items to end the program. What's going on with Wisconsin deer hunting season? Most hunters have described the conditions as ideal. It was cold on opening weekend, but there was snow cover in most parts of the state. It's warmed up a bit. The numbers are always on a 1 to 2 day lag because you don't report often instantaneously, and a lot of the reporting isn't done in real time. But on the opening weekend, the number of deer killed was, as is now being called by the DNR, at 102,000. There's two ways to look at that number. First of all, it's a significant jump over last year, 2021, a 15% increase. However, let's see the guy's name here. DNR Deer Program Specialist Jeff Pritzel said that this is actually a number that is in line with the five-year average. So it's about an average year. Simply last year was very, very low. They also caution, often in deer hunting season, after a busy opening weekend, you can have a slow closing weekend, or vice versa, that a lot of hunters hunt until they get their deer. So the numbers may slow down as the week goes along. I should point out that the weather conditions for hunting, I would say, are pretty close to perfect for the remainder of the week. And next, everybody is debating whether or not the Republican nominee for president in 2024 is going to be Ron DeSantis or Donald Trump. But here's the really interesting question. What if it isn't either of them? Who is the most likely third alternative? I can tell you who the betting markets are listing as the third likeliest choice. But I put the question to myself, and if I had to, they gave me three guesses, pick with a Republican, of course I would put on Trump and DeSantis, as would everybody else. They're the clear two front runners. If it isn't one of those two and you had to pick one who you think, not who you want to win, but would be likeliest to win, who would you name? Paul said Rubio. I didn't even consider him. Anyway, the third choice, and it's a distant third in the odds, is Mike Pence, followed by Nikki Haley, followed by Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State in the Trump administration, and followed after that by Candace Owens. I think fair to say that if it isn't DeSantis or Trump, if, for example, they nuke one another out, which is possible, it's wide open and it could be almost anybody. There are people talking about Wisconsin's own Paul Ryan running for president. Ryan made the famous statement over the weekend that I was never really a never Trumper, but I'm a never again Trumper, or however he put it, for those who still care what Paul Ryan has to say. And with that, we're out of time for today's program. Quick reminder that tomorrow we'll be doing our football picking contest at around 5:45. Again, for obvious reasons, Thursday being Thanksgiving. If you hadn't picked up on that, you know that Thursday was Thanksgiving. Is your wife cooking the turkey? Are you going? You're going to other family members' homes. So somebody, oh, two of them, that's always a problem, is it? Oh, the noon and five thing, but that's, see, I'm against that. I think only go to one of them. Because you don't know if you're supposed to eat the full dinner at noon, then you show up at five, and then they hack the other people up. Paul said he just eats and eats and eats, and he doesn't relate. Clearly, we've run out of things to say, which is good because the show is over. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye.